This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Mortal Instruments, Book 6, City of Heavenly Fire, by Cassandra Clare. Read by Sophie Turner and Jason Doring.
In God 'tis glory, and when men aspire, 'tis but a spark too much of heavenly fire. John Dryden, Absalom and Achitophel.
Prologue. Fall like rain. The Los Angeles Institute, December 2007. On the day Emma Carstairs's parents were killed, the weather was perfect. On the other hand, the weather was usually perfect in Los Angeles. Emma's mother and father dropped her off on a clear winter morning at the Institute in the hills behind the Pacific Coast Highway, overlooking the blue ocean. The sky was a cloudless expanse that stretched from the cliffs of the Pacific Palisades to the beaches at Point Hume. A report had come in the night before of demonic activity near the beach caves of Leo Carrillo. The Carstairs had been assigned to look into it. Later, Emma would remember her mother tucking a wind-blown strand of hair behind her ear as she offered to draw a fearless rune on Emma's father, and John Carstairs laughing and saying he wasn't sure how he felt about newfangled runes. He was fine with what was written in the Grey Book, thanks very much. At the time, though, Emma was impatient with her parents, hugging them quickly before pulling away to race up the Institute steps, her backpack bouncing between her shoulders as they waved goodbye from the courtyard. Emma loved that she got to train at the Institute. Not only did her best friend Julian live there, but she always felt as if she was flying into the ocean when she went inside it. It was a massive structure of wood and stone at the end of a long pebble drive that wound through the hills. Every room, every floor looked out over the ocean and the mountains and the sky, rippling expanses of blue and green and gold. Emma's dream was to climb up onto the roof with Jules, though so far they'd been foiled by parents, to see if the view stretched all the way to the desert in the south. The front doors knew her and gave way easily under her familiar touch. The entryway and lower floors of the Institute were full of adult shadow hunters, striding back and forth. Some kind of meeting, Emma guessed. She caught sight of Julian's father, Andrew Blackthorn, the head of the Institute, amid the crowd. Not wanting to be slowed down by greetings, she dashed for the changing room on the second floor where she swapped her jeans and t-shirt for training clothes, oversized shirt, loose cotton pants, and the most important item of all, the blade slung over her shoulder. Cortana. The name simply meant short sword, but it wasn't short to Emma. It was the length of her forearm, sparkling metal, the blade inscribed with words that never failed to cause a shiver down her spine. I am Cortana, of the same steel and temper as Joyeuse and Durandal. Her father had explained what it meant when he put the sword in her 10-year-old hands for the first time. You can use this for training until you're 18 when it becomes yours, John Carstairs had said, smiling down at her as her fingers traced the words. Do you understand what that means? She'd shaken her head. Steel, she understood, but not temper. Temper meant anger. Something her father was always warning her she should control. What did it have to do with a blade? You know of the Whalum family, he'd said. They were famous weapon makers before the Iron Sisters began to forge all the Shadow Hunter blades. Whalum the Smith made Excalibur and Joyeuse, Arthur's and Lancelot's swords, and Durandal, the sword of the hero Roland. And they made this sword, too, from the same steel. All steel must be tempered, subjected to great heat, almost enough to melt or destroy the metal, to make it stronger. He'd kissed the top of her head. Carstairs have carried this sword for generations. The inscription reminds us that shadow hunters are the angels' weapons. Temper us in the fire and we grow stronger. When we suffer, we survive. Emma could hardly wait the 6 years until she would be 18. When she could travel the world to fight demons, when she could be tempered in fire. Now she strapped the sword on and left the changing room, picturing how it would be. In her imagination, she was standing on top of the bluffs over the sea at Point Hume, fending off a cadre of Ram demons with Cortana. Julian was with her, of course, wielding his own favorite weapon, the crossbow. In Emma's mind, Jules was always there. Emma had known him for as long as she could remember. The Blackthorns and the Carstairs had always been close, and Jules was only a few months older. She'd literally never lived in a world without him in it. She'd learned to swim in the ocean with him when they'd both been babies. They'd learned to walk together and then run together. She had been carried in his parents' arms and corralled by his older brother and sister when misbehaving. And they'd misbehaved often. Dyeing the puffy white Blackthorn family cat Oscar bright blue had been Emma's idea when they were both 7. Julian had taken the blame anyway. He often did. After all, he'd pointed out she was an only child and he was 1 of 7. His parents would forget they were angry with him a lot more quickly than hers would. She remembered when his mother had died just after Tavi had been born, and how Emma had stood holding Jules's hand while the body had burned in the canyons and the smoke had climbed towards the sky. She remembered that he'd cried, and remembered thinking that boys cried so differently from girls, with awful, ragged sobs that sounded like they were being pulled out with hooks. Maybe it was worse for them because they weren't supposed to cry. Oh! Emma staggered back. She'd been so lost in thought that she plowed right into Julian's father, a tall man with the same tousled brown hair as most of his children. Sorry, Mr. Blackthorn. He grinned. Never seen anyone so eager to get to lessons before, he called as she darted down the hall. The training room was one of Emma's favorite rooms in the whole building. It took up almost an entire level, and both the east and west walls were clear glass. You could see blue sea nearly everywhere you looked. The curve of the coastline was visible from north to south, the endless water of the Pacific stretching out towards Hawaii. In the center of the highly polished wood floor stood the Blackthorn family tutor, a commanding woman named Katarina, currently engaged in teaching knife throwing to the twins. Livy was following instructions obligingly, as she always did, but Ty was scowling and resistant. Julian, in his loose, light training clothes, was lying on his back near the west window, talking to Mark, who had his head stuck in a book and was doing his best to ignore his younger half-brother. Don't you think Mark is kind of a weird name for a shadow hunter? Julian was saying as Emma approached. I mean, if you really think about it, it's confusing. Put a mark on me, Mark. Mark lifted his blonde head from the book he was reading and glared at his younger brother. Julian was idly twirling a steely in his hand. He held it like a paintbrush, something Emma was always scolding him about. You were supposed to hold a steely like a steely as if it were an extension of your hand, not an artist's tool. Mark sighed theatrically. At 16, he was just enough their senior to find everything Emma and Julian did either annoying or ridiculous. If it bothers you, you can call me by my full name, he said. Mark Anthony Blackthorn? Julian wrinkled his nose. It takes a long time to say. What if we got attacked by a demon? By the time I was halfway through saying your name, you'd be dead. In this situation, are you saving my life? Mark asked. Getting ahead of yourself, don't you think, Pipsqueak? It could happen. Julian, not pleased to be called a Pipsqueak, sat up. His hair stuck out in wild tufts all over his head. His older sister Helen was always attacking him with hairbrushes, but it never did any good. He had the Blackthorn hair, like his father and most of his brothers and sisters, wildly wavy, the color of dark chocolate. The family resemblance always fascinated Emma, who looked very little like either of her parents, unless you counted the fact that her father was blonde. Helen had been in Idris for months now with her girlfriend Aline. They had exchanged family rings and they were very serious about each other, according to Emma's parents, which mostly meant they looked at each other in a soppy way. Emma was determined that if she ever fell in love, she would not be soppy in that manner. She understood that there was some amount of fuss about the fact that both Helen and Aline were girls, but she didn't understand why. And the Blackthorn seemed to like Aline a lot. She was a calming presence and kept Helen from fretting. Helen's current absence did mean that no one was cutting Jules's hair, and the sunlight in the room turned the curling tips of it to gold. The windows along the east wall showed the shadowy sweep of the mountains that separated the sea from the San Fernando Valley. Dry, dusty hills riddled with canyons, cacti, and thorn bushes. Sometimes the shadow hunters went outside to train, and Emma loved these moments. loved finding hidden paths and secret waterfalls and the sleepy lizards that rested on the rocks near them. Julian was adept at coaxing the lizards to crawl into his palm and sleep there as he stroked their heads with his thumb. "Watch out!" Emma ducked as a wooden-tipped blade flew by her head and bounced off the window, hitting Mark in the leg on the rebound. He tossed his book down and stood up, scowling. Mark was technically on secondary supervision, backing up Katerina, although he preferred reading to teaching. "Tiberius," Mark said, "do not throw knives at me." "It was an accident." Livy moved to stand between her twin and Mark. Tiberius was as dark as Mark was fair, the only one of the Blackthorns, other than Mark and Helen, who didn't quite count because of their downworlder blood, not to have the brown hair and blue-green eyes that were the family traits. Ty had curly black hair and grey eyes, the colour of iron. "No, it wasn't," said Ty. "I was aiming at you." Mark took an exaggerated deep breath and ran his hands through his hair, which left it sticking up in spikes. Mark had the Blackthorn eyes, the colour of verdigris. But his hair, like Helen's, was pale white blonde as his mother's had been. The rumour was that Mark's mother had been a princess of the Seelie court. She had had an affair with Andrew Blackthorn that had produced two children, whom she'd abandoned on the doorstep of the Los Angeles Institute one night before disappearing forever. Julian's father had taken in his half-fairy children and raised them as Shadowhunters. Shadowhunter blood was dominant, and though the council didn't like it, they would accept part downworlder children into the clave as long as their skin could tolerate runes. Both Helen and Mark had been first runed at 10 years old, and their skin held the rune safely, though Emma could tell that being runed hurt Mark more than it hurt an ordinary shadow hunter. She noticed him wincing, though he tried to hide it when the steely was set to his skin. Lately she'd been noticing a lot more things about Mark. The way the odd fairy-influenced shape of his face was appealing and the breadth of his shoulders under his t-shirts. She didn't know why she was noticing those things, and she didn't exactly like it. It made her want to snap at Mark or hide, often at the same time. "You're staring," Julian said, looking at Emma over the knees of his paint-splattered training gear. She snapped back to attention. "At what?" "At Mark, again." He sounded annoyed. "Shut up," Emma hissed under her breath and grabbed for his steely. He grabbed it back and a tussle ensued. Emma giggled as she rolled away from Julian. She'd been training with him for so long she knew every move he'd make before he made it. The only problem was that she was inclined to go too easy on him. The thought of anyone hurting Julian made her furious, and sometimes that included herself. "Is this about the bees in your room?" Mark was demanding as he strode over to Tiberius. "You know why we had to get rid of those." "I assume you did it to thwart me," Ty said. Ty was small for his age, 10. But he had the vocabulary and diction of an 80-year-old. Ty didn't tell lies, usually, mostly because he didn't understand why he might need to. He couldn't understand why some of the things he did annoyed or upset people, and he found that anger either baffling or frightening, depending on his mood. "It's not about thwarting you, Ty. You just can't have bees in your room." "I was studying them," Ty explained, his pale face flushing. "It was important, and they were my friends, and I knew what I was doing."
"Just like you knew what you were doing with a rattlesnake that time," said Mark.
"Sometimes we take things away from you because we don't want you to get hurt. I know it's hard to understand, Ty, but we love you."
Ty looked at him blankly. He knew what "I love you" meant, and he knew it was good, but he didn't understand why it was an explanation for anything.
Mark bent down, hands on his knees, keeping his eyes level with Ty's gray ones.
"Okay, here's what we're gonna do."
Ha! Emma managed to flip Julian on his back and wrestle his steely away from him. He laughed, wriggling under her until she pinned his arm to the ground.
"I give up," he said. "I give..."
He was laughing up at her, and she was struck suddenly with the realization that the feeling of lying directly on top of Jules was actually sort of weird. And also the realization that, like Mark, he had a nice shape to his face. Round and boyish and really familiar. But she could almost see through the face he had now to the face he would have when he was older. The sound of the Institute doorbell echoed through the room. It was a deep, sweet chiming noise, like church bells.
From outside, the institute looked to mundane eyes like the ruins of an old Spanish mission, even though there were private property and keep-out signs posted everywhere. Sometimes people, usually mundanes with a slight dose of the sight, managed to wander up to the front door anyway. Emma rolled off Julian and brushed at her clothes. She had stopped laughing. Julian sat up, propping himself on his hands, his eyes curious. "Everything okay?" he said. "Bang my elbow," she lied, and looked over at the others. Livy was letting Katerina show her how to hold the knife, and Ty was shaking his head at Mark. Ty. She'd been the one to give Tiberius his nickname when he was born, because at 18 months old she hadn't been able to say Tiberius, and called him Ty-Ty instead. Sometimes she wondered if he remembered. It was strange, the things that mattered to Ty and the things that didn't. You couldn't predict them. "Emma?" Julian leaned forward, and everything seemed to explode around them. There was a sudden, enormous flash of light, and the world outside the windows turned white gold and red, as if the Institute had caught fire. At the same time, the floor under them rocked like the deck of a ship. Emma slid forward just as a terrible screaming rose from downstairs, a horrible, unrecognizable scream. Livy gasped and went for Ty, wrapped her arms around him as if she could encircle and protect his body with her own. Livy was one of the very few people Ty didn't mind touching him. He stood with his eyes wide, one of his hands caught in the sleeve of his sister's shirt. Mark had risen to his feet already. Katerina was pale under her coils of dark hair. "You stay here," she said to Emma and Julian, drawing her sword from the sheath at her waist. "Watch the twins. Mark, come with me."
"No,"
Julian said, scrambling to his feet. "Mark..."
"I'll be fine, Jules," Mark said with a reassuring smile. He already had a dagger in each hand. He was quick and fast with knives, his aim unerring.
"Stay with Emma," he said, nodding towards both of them. And then he vanished after Katerina, the door of the training room shutting behind them. Jules edged closer to Emma, slipped his hand into hers, and helped her to her feet. She wanted to point out to him that she was just fine and could stand on her own, but she let it go. She understood the urge to feel as if he were doing something, anything to help. Another scream suddenly rose from downstairs. There was the sound of glass shattering. Emma hurried across the room towards the twins. They were deadly still, like little statues. Livy was ashen. Ty was clutching her shirt with a death grip.
"It's going to be okay," Jules said, putting his hand between his brother's thin shoulder blades.
"Whatever it is..."
"You have no idea what it is," Ty said in a clipped voice.
"You can't say it's going to be okay. You don't know."
There was another noise then. It was worse than the sound of a scream. It was a terrible howl, feral and vicious.
Werewolves? Emma thought with bewilderment, but she'd heard a werewolf's cry before. This was something much darker and crueler.
Livy huddled against Ty's shoulder. He raised his little white face, his eyes tracking from Emma to rest on Julian.
"If we hide here," Ty said, "and whatever it is finds us and they hurt our sister, then it's your fault."
Livy's face was hidden against Ty. He had spoken softly, but Emma had no doubt he meant it. For all Ty's frightening intellect, for all his strangeness and indifference to other people, he was inseparable from his twin. If Livy was sick, Ty slept at the foot of her bed. If she got a scratch, he panicked, and it was the same the other way round. Emma saw the conflicting emotions chase themselves across Julian's face. His eyes sought hers, and she nodded minutely. The idea of staying in the training room and waiting for whatever had made that sound to come to them made her skin feel as if it were peeling off her bones. Julian strode across the room and then returned with a recurve crossbow and two daggers.
"You have to let go of Livy now, Ty," he said, and after a moment the twins separated. Jules handed Livy a dagger and offered the other one to Tiberius, who stared at it as if it were an alien thing.
"Ty," Jules said, dropping his hand. "Why did you have the bees in your room? What is it you like about them?"
Ty said nothing.
"You like the way they work together, right?" Julian said.
"Well, we have to work together now. We're going to get to the office and make a call out to the Clave, okay? A distress call, so they'll send backup to protect us."
Ty held his hand out for the dagger with a curt nod. "That's what I would have suggested if Mark and Katerina had listened to me."
"He would have," Livy said. She had taken the dagger with more confidence than Ty, and held it as if she knew what she was doing with the blade.
"It's what he was thinking about."
"We're going to have to be very quiet now," Jules said. You two are going to follow me to the office.
He raised his eyes. His gaze met Emma's.
Emma's going to get Tavi and Drew and meet us there, okay?
Emma's heart swooped and plummeted like a seabird. Octavian, Tavi, the baby only 2 years old, and Drew, 8, too young to start physical training. Of course someone was going to have to get them both, and Jules's eyes were pleading.
Yes, she said. That's exactly what I'm going to do.
Cortana was strapped to Emma's back, a throwing knife in her hand. She thought she could feel the metal pulsing through her veins like a heartbeat as she slipped down the institute corridor, her back to the wall. Every once in a while, the hallway would open out into windows, and the sight of the blue sea and the green mountains and the peaceful white clouds would tease her. She thought of her parents, somewhere out on the beach, having no idea what was happening at the institute. She wished they were here, and at the same time was glad they weren't. At least they were safe. She was in the part of the institute that was most familiar to her now, the family quarters. She slipped past Helen's empty bedroom, clothes packed up and her coverlet dusty, past Julian's room, familiar from a million sleepovers, and Mark's, door firmly shut. The next room was Mr. Blackthorne's, and just beside it was the nursery. Emma took a deep breath and shouldered the door open. The sight that met her eyes in the little blue-painted room made them widen. Tavi was in his crib, his small hands clutching the bars, cheeks bright red from screaming. Drusilla stood in front of the crib, a sword Angel knew as she'd gotten it, clutched in her hand. It was pointed directly at Emma. Drew's hand was shaking enough that the point of the sword was dancing around. Her braid stuck out either side of her plump face, but the look in her Blackthorne eyes was one of steely determination. "Don't you dare touch my brother."
"Drew," Emma said as softly as she could.
"Drew, it's me. Jules sent me to get you."
Drew dropped the sword with a clatter and burst into tears. Emma swept past her and seized the baby out of his crib with her free arm, heaving him up onto her hip. Tavi was small for his age, but still weighed a good 25 pounds. She winced as he clutched onto her hair.
"Mema," he said.
"Shush."
She kissed the top of his head. He smelled like baby powder and tears.
"Drew, grab onto my belt, okay? We're going to the office. We'll be safe there."
Drew took hold of Emma's weapons belt with her small hands. She'd already stopped crying. Shadowhunters didn't cry much, even when they were 8. Emma led the way out into the hall. The sounds from below were worse now. The screams were still going on, the deep howling, the sounds of glass breaking and wood ripping. Emma inched forward, clutching Tavi, murmuring over and over that everything was all right, he'd be all right. And there were more windows, and the sun slashed through them viciously, almost blinding her. She was blinded by panic and the sun. It was the only explanation for the wrong turn she took next. She turned down a corridor, and instead of finding herself in the hallway that she expected, she found herself standing atop the wide staircase that led down to the foyer and the large double doors that were the building's entrance. The foyer was filled with shadow hunters, some familiar to her as the Nephilim of the Los Angeles Conclave, in black, others in red gear. There were rows of statuary, now toppled over in pieces and powder on the ground. The picture window that opened onto the sea had been smashed, and broken glass and blood were everywhere. Emma felt a sick lurch in her stomach. In the middle of the foyer stood a tall figure in scarlet. He was pale blonde, almost white-haired, and his face looked like the carved marble face of Raziel, only entirely without mercy. His eyes were coal black, and in one hand he carried a sword stamped with a pattern of stars. In the other, a goblet made of shimmering adamas. The sight of the cup triggered something in Emma's mind. The adults didn't like to talk about politics around the younger shadow hunters, but she knew that Valentine Morgenstern's son had taken on a different name and sworn vengeance against the Clave. She knew that he had made a cup that was the reverse of the Angel's cup, that changed shadowhunters into evil, demonic creatures. She had heard Mr. Blackthorne call the evil shadowhunters the Endarkened Ones. He had said he'd rather die than be one. This was him, then, Jonathan Morgenstern, whom everyone called Sebastian. A figure out of a fairy tale, a story told to frighten children, come to life. Valentine's son. Emma put a hand to the back of Tavi's head, pressing his face into her shoulder. She couldn't move.
She felt as if lead weights were attached to her feet. All around Sebastian were shadow hunters in black and red and figures in dark cloaks. Were they shadow hunters too? She couldn't tell. Their faces were hidden. And there was Mark, his hands being held behind his back by a shadow hunter in red gear. His daggers lay at his feet and there was blood on his training clothes. Sebastian raised a hand and crooked a long white finger. "Bring her," he said. There was a rustle in the crowd and Mr. Blackthorne stepped forward, dragging Katerina with him. She was fighting, beating at him with her hands, but he was too strong. Emma watched in disbelieving horror as Mr. Blackthorne pushed her to her knees. "Now," said Sebastian in a voice like silk, "drink of the infernal cup." And he forced the rim of the cup between Katerina's teeth. That was when Emma found out what the terrible howling noise she had heard before was. Katerina tried to fight free, but Sebastian was too strong. He jammed the cup past her lips, and Emma saw her gasp and swallow. She wrenched away, and this time Mr. Blackthorne let her. He was laughing, and so was Sebastian. Katerina fell to the ground, her body spasming, and from her throat came a single scream, worse than a scream, a howl of pain, as if her soul were being torn out of her body. A laugh went around the room. Sebastian smiled. There was something horrible and beautiful about him, the way there was something horrible and beautiful about poisonous snakes and great white sharks. He was flanked by two companions, Emma realized, a woman with graying brown hair, an axe in her hands, and a tall figure wrapped entirely in a black cloak. No part of him was visible except the dark boots that showed beneath the hem of his robe. Only his height and breadth made her think he was a man at all. "Is that the last of the shadow hunters here?" Sebastian asked.
"There is the boy, Mark Blackthorne," said the woman standing beside him, raising a finger and pointing at Mark. "He ought to be old enough."
Sebastian looked down at Katerina, who had stopped her spasming and lay still, her dark hair tangled across her face. "Get up, Sister Katerina," he said. "Go and bring Mark Blackthorne to me." Emma watched, rooted to the spot, as Katerina rose slowly to her feet. Katerina had been the tutor at the Institute for as long as Emma could remember. She had been their teacher when Tavi had been born, when Jules' mother had died, when Emma had first started physical training. She had taught them languages and bound up cuts and sewed scrapes and given them their first weapons. She had been like family. And now she stepped, blank-eyed, across the mess on the floor and reached out to seize Mark. Drew gave a gasp, snapping Emma back to consciousness. Emma whirled and placed Tavi in Drew's arms. Drew staggered a little and then recovered, clutching her baby brother tight. "Run," Emma said. "Run to the office. Tell Julian I'll be right there." Something of the urgency in Emma's voice communicated itself. Drusilla didn't argue, just clutched Tavi more tightly and fled, her bare little feet soundless on the corridor floors. Emma spun back to stare down at the unfolding horror. Katerina was behind Mark, pushing him ahead, a dagger pressed to the space between his shoulder blades. He staggered and nearly stumbled in front of Sebastian. Mark was closer to the steps now, and Emma could see that he had been fighting. There were defensive wounds on his wrists and hands, cuts on his face, and there had doubtless been no time for healing wounds. There was blood all over his right cheek. Sebastian looked at him, lip curling in annoyance.
"This one is not all Nephilim," he said. "Heart fairy, am I correct? Why was I not informed?"
There was a murmur. The brown-haired woman said,
"Does it mean the cup will not work on him, Lord Sebastian?"
"It means I don't want him," said Sebastian.
"We could take him to the Valley of Salt," said the brown-haired woman, "or to the high places of Edom, and sacrifice him there for the pleasure of Asmodeus and Lilith."
"No," Sebastian said slowly. "No, it would not be wise, I think, to do that to one with the blood of the fair folk."
Mark spat at him. Sebastian looked startled. He turned to Julian's father.
"Come and restrain him," he said. "Wound him if you desire. I shall have only so much patience with your half-breed son."
Mr. Blackthorne stepped forward, holding a broadsword. The blade was already stained with blood. Mark's eyes widened with terror.
The sword rose up. The throwing knife left Emma's hand. It flew through the air and buried itself in Sebastian Morgenstern's chest. Sebastian staggered back, and Mr. Blackthorne's sword hand fell to his side. The others were crying out. Mark leapt to his feet as Sebastian looked down at the blade in his chest, its handle protruding from his heart. He frowned. "Ouch," he said, and pulled the knife free. The blade was slick with blood, but Sebastian himself looked unbothered by the injury. He cast the weapon aside, staring upward. Emma felt those dark, empty eyes on her like the touch of cold fingers. She felt him take the measure of her, sum her up and know her and dismiss her. "It's a shame you won't live," he said to her. "Live to tell the Clave that Lilith has strengthened me beyond all measure. Perhaps a glorious could end my life. A pity for the Nephilim that they have no more favors they can ask of heaven, and none of the puny instruments of war they forge in their adamant citadel can harm me now." He turned to the others. "Kill the girl," he demanded, flicking at his now bloody jacket with distaste. Emma saw Mark lunge for the stairs, trying to get to her first, but the dark figure at Sebastian's side had already seized Mark and was drawing him backward with black-gloved hands. Those arms went around Mark, held him, almost as if protecting him. Mark was struggling, and then he was lost to Emma's view as the Andarkans surged up the steps. Emma turned and ran. She had learned to run on the beaches of California, where the sand shifted under her feet with every step. So on solid ground, she was as fast as the wind. She hurtled down the hall, her hair flying out behind her, leaped and jumped down a short set of steps, spun to the right and burst into the office. She slammed the door behind her and threw the bolt before turning to stare. The office was a sizable room, the walls lined with reference books. There was another library on the top floor as well, but this was where Mr. Blackthorne had run the institute. There was his mahogany desk, and on it two telephones, one white and one black. The receiver was off the hook on the black phone, and Julian was holding the handset, shouting down the line. "You have to keep the portal open. We're not all safe yet, please." The door behind Emma boomed and echoed as the Andarkand threw themselves against it. Julian looked up with alarm, and the receiver fell from his fingers as he saw Emma. She stared back at him and passed him to where the whole eastern wall was glowing. In the center was a portal, a rectangular-shaped hole in the wall through which Emma could see whirling silver shapes, a chaos of clouds and wind. She staggered toward Julian, and he caught her by the shoulders. His fingers gripped her skin tightly, as if he couldn't believe she was there or real. "Emma," he breathed, and then his voice picked up speed. "And where's Mark? Where's my father?" She shook her head. "They can't. I couldn't." She swallowed. "It's Sebastian Morgenstern," she said, and winced as the door shuddered again under another assault. "We have to go back for them," she said, turning, but Julian's hand was already around her wrist. "The portal," he shouted over the sound of the wind and the battering at the door. "It goes to Idris. The Clave opened it. Emma, it's going to stay open for only another few seconds." "But Mark," she said, though she had no idea what they could do, how they could fight their way past the Andarkand crowding the hallway, how they could defeat Sebastian Morgenstern, who was more powerful than any ordinary shadow hunter. "We have to, Emma," Julian shouted, and then the door burst open, and the Andarkand poured into the room. She heard the brown-haired woman shrieking after her, something about how the Nephilim would burn, they would all burn in the fires of Edom, they would all burn and die and be destroyed. Julian bolted toward the portal, dragging Emma by one hand. After one terrified look behind her, she let him pull her along. She ducked as an arrow sailed past them and smashed through a window on her right. Julian seized her frantically, wrapping his arms around her. She felt his fingers knot into the back of her shirt as they fell forward into the portal and were swallowed up by the tempest.
Part 1. Bring forth a fire. "Therefore will I bring forth a fire from the midst of thee. It shall devour thee, and I will bring thee to ashes upon the earth, in the sight of all them that behold thee. All they that know thee among the people shall be astonished at thee. Thou shalt be a terror. and never shalt thou be any more. Ezekiel 28:14. 1. The portion of their cup. Picture something calming. The beach in Los Angeles. White sand. Crashing blue water. You're strolling along the tide line. Jace cracked an eye open. This sounds very romantic. The boy sitting across from him sighed and ran his hands through his shaggy dark hair. Though it was a cold December day, werewolves didn't feel weather as acutely as humans, and Jordan had his jacket off and his shirt sleeves rolled up. They were seated opposite each other on a patch of browning grass in a clearing in Central Park, both cross-legged, their hands on their knees, palms up. An outcropping of rock rose from the ground near them. It was broken up into larger and smaller boulders, and atop one of the larger boulders perched Alec and Isabel Lightwood. As Jace looked up, Isabel caught his eye and gave him an encouraging wave. Alec, noting her gesture, smacked her shoulder. Jace could see him lecturing Izzy, probably about not breaking Jace's concentration. He smiled to himself. Neither of them really had a reason to be here, but they had come anyway, for moral support. Though, Jace suspected it had more to do with the fact that Alec hated to be at loose ends these days, Isabel hated for her brother to be on his own, and both of them were avoiding their parents and the Institute. Jordan snapped his fingers under Jace's nose. "Are you paying any attention?" Jace frowned. "I was, until we wandered into the territory of bad personal ads." "Well, what kind of thing does make you feel calm and peaceful?" Jace took his hands off his knees, the lotus position was giving him wrist cramps, and leaned back on his arms. Chilly wind rattled the few dead leaves that still clung to the branches of the trees. Against the pale winter sky, the leaves had a spare elegance, like pen and ink sketches. "Killing demons," he said. "A good clean kill is very relaxing. The messy ones are more annoying because you have to clean up afterward."
"No!"
Jordan held his hands up. Below the sleeves of his shirt, the tattoos that wrapped his arms were visible. Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Jace knew it meant the peace that passes understanding, and that you were supposed to say the word 3 times every time you uttered the mantra to calm your mind. But nothing seemed to calm his these days. The fire in his veins made his mind race too, thoughts coming too quickly, one after another, like exploding fireworks. Dreams as vivid and saturated with color as oil paintings. He'd tried training it out of himself, hours and hours spent in the practice room, blood and bruises and sweat, and once, even, broken fingers. But he hadn't managed to do much more than irritate Alec with requests for healing runes and, on one memorable occasion, accidentally set fire to one of the crossbeams. It was Simon who had pointed out that his roommate meditated every day, and who'd said that learning the habit was what had calmed the uncontrollable fits of rage that were often part of the transformation into a werewolf. From there, it had been a short jump to Clary, suggesting that Jace might as well try it, and here they were at his second session. The first session had ended with Jace burning a mark into Simon and Jordan's hardwood floor, so Jordan had suggested they take it outside for the second round to prevent further property damage. "No killing," Jordan said. "We're trying to make you feel peaceful. Blood, killing, war, those are all non-peaceful things. Isn't there anything else you like?"
"Weapons," said Jace. "I like weapons."
"I'm starting to think we have a problematic issue of personal philosophy here." Jace leaned forward, his palms flat on the grass.
"I'm a warrior," he said. "I was brought up as a warrior. I didn't have toys, I had weapons. I slept with a wooden sword until I was 5. My first books were medieval demonologies with illuminated pages. The first songs I learned were chants to banish demons. I know what brings me peace, and it isn't sandy beaches or chirping birds in rainforests. I want a weapon in my hand, and a strategy to win."
Jordan looked at him levelly. "So you're saying what brings you peace is war?" Jace threw his hands up and stood, brushing grass off his jeans. "Now you get it." He heard the crackle of dry grass and turned in time to see Clary duck through a gap between 2 trees and emerge into the clearing, Simon only a few steps behind her.
Clary had her hands in her back pockets, and she was laughing. Jace watched them for a moment. There was something about looking at people who didn't know they were being watched. He remembered the second time he had ever seen Clary, across the main room of Java Jones. She'd been laughing and talking with Simon the way she was doing now. He remembered the unfamiliar twist of jealousy in his chest, pressing out his breath, the feeling of satisfaction when she'd left Simon behind to come and talk to him. Things did change. He'd gone from being eaten up with jealousy of Simon to a grudging respect for his tenacity and courage, to actually considering him a friend, though he doubted he'd ever say so out loud. Jace watched as Clary looked over and blew him a kiss, her red hair bouncing in its ponytail. She was so small, delicate, doll-like, he had once thought, before he'd learned how strong she was. She headed toward Jason Jordan, leaving Simon to scamper up the rocky ground to where Alec and Isabel were sitting. He collapsed beside Isabel, who immediately leaned over to say something to him, her black curtain of hair hiding her face. Clary stopped in front of Jace, rocking back on her heels with a smile. "How's it coming along?" "Jordan wants me to think about the beach," Jace said gloomily. "He's stubborn," Clary said to Jordan. "What he means is that he appreciates it." "I don't, really," said Jace. Jordan snorted. "Without me, you'd be bouncing down Madison Avenue, shooting sparks out of all your orifices." He rose to his feet, shrugging on his green jacket. "Your boyfriend's crazy," he said to Clary. "Yeah, but he's hot," said Clary. "So there's that." Jordan made a face, but it was good-natured. "I'm heading out," he said. "Gotta meet Maya downtown." He gave a mock salute and was gone, slipping into the trees and vanishing with the silent tread of the wolf he was under the skin. Jace watched him go. "Unlikely saviors," he thought. 6 months ago, he wouldn't have believed anyone who'd told him he was going to wind up taking behavioral lessons from a werewolf. Jordan and Simon and Jace had struck up something of a friendship in the past months. Jace couldn't help using their apartment as a refuge, away from the daily pressures of the Institute, away from the reminders that the Clave was still unprepared for war with Sebastian. Erhome. The word brushed the back of Jace's mind like the touch of a feather, making him shiver. He saw an angel's wing, torn from its body, lying in a pool of golden blood. "I am coming."
"What's wrong?" Clary said. Jace suddenly looked a million miles away. Since the heavenly fire had entered his body, he tended to drift off more into his head. She had a feeling that it was a side effect of suppressing his emotions. She felt a little pang. Jace, when she had met him, had been so controlled, only a little of his real self leaking out through the cracks in his personal armor, like light through the chinks in a wall. It had taken a long time to break down those defenses. Now, though, the fire in his veins was forcing him to put them back up, to bite down on his emotions for safety's sake. But when the fire was gone, would he be able to dismantle them again? He blinked, called back by her voice. The winter sun was high and cold. It sharpened the bones of his face and threw the shadows under his eyes into relief. He reached for her hand, taking a deep breath. "You're right," he said in the quiet, more serious voice he reserved only for her. "It is helping, the lessons with Jordan. It is helping, and I do appreciate it." "I know." Clary curled her hand around his wrist. His skin felt warm under her touch. He seemed to run several degrees hotter than normal since his encounter with Glorious. His heart still pounded its familiar steady rhythm, but the blood being pushed through his veins seemed to thrum under her touch with the kinetic energy of a fire just about to catch. She went up on her toes to kiss his cheek, but he turned and their lips brushed. They'd done nothing more than kiss since the fire had first started singing in his blood, and they'd done even that carefully. Jace was careful now, his mouth sliding softly against hers, his hand closing on her shoulder. For a moment they were body to body, and she felt the thrum and pulse of his blood. He moved to pull her closer, and a sharp, dry spark passed between them, like the zing of static electricity.
Jace broke off the kiss and stepped back with an exhale. Before Clary could say anything, a chorus of sarcastic applause broke out from the nearby hill. Simon, Isabel, and Alec waved at them. Jace bowed, while Clary stepped back slightly sheepishly, hooking her thumbs into the belt of her jeans. Jace sighed. Shall we join our annoying, voyeuristic friends? Unfortunately, that's the only kind of friends we have. Clary bumped her shoulder against his arm, and they headed up towards the rocks. Simon and Isabel were side by side, talking quietly. Alec was sitting a little apart, staring at the screen of his phone with an expression of intense concentration. Jace threw himself down next to his parabatai.
I've heard that if you stare at those things enough, they'll ring.
He's been texting Magnus, said Isabel, glancing over with a disapproving look.
I haven't, Alec said automatically.
Yes, you have, said Jace, craning to look over Alec's shoulder. And, calling, I can see your outgoing calls. It's his birthday, Alec said, flipping the phone shut. He looked smaller these days, almost skinny in his worn blue pullover, holes at the elbows, his lips bitten and chapped.
Clary's heart went out to him. He'd spent the first week after Magnus had broken up with him in a sort of daze of sadness and disbelief. None of them could really believe it. She'd always thought Magnus loved Alec, really loved him. Clearly, Alec had thought so too.
I didn't want him to think that I didn't, to think that I forgot.
You're pining, said Jace.
Alec shrugged.
Look who's talking. Oh, I love her. Oh, she's my sister. Oh, why?
Jace threw a handful of dead leaves at Alec, making him splutter. Isabel was laughing.
You know he's right, Jace.
Give me your phone, Jace said, ignoring Isabel.
Come on, Alexander.
It's none of your business, Alec said, holding the phone away. Just forget about it, okay?
You don't eat, you don't sleep, you stare at your phone and I'm supposed to forget about it, Jace said.
There was a surprising amount of agitation in his voice. Clary knew how upset he'd been that Alec was unhappy, but she wasn't sure Alec knew it. Under normal circumstances, Jace would have killed or at least threatened anyone who hurt Alec. This was different. Jace liked to win. But you couldn't win out over a broken heart, even someone else's. Even someone you loved. Jace leaned over and grabbed the phone out of his parabatai's hand. Alec protested and reached for it, but Jace held him off with one hand, expertly scrolling through the messages on the phone with the other.
Magnus, just call me back. I need to know if you're okay.
He shook his head. Okay, no, just no. With a decisive move, he snapped the phone in half. The screen went blank as Jace dropped the pieces to the ground. There. Alec looked down at the shattered pieces in disbelief.
You broke my phone!
Jace shrugged.
Guys, don't let other guys keep calling other guys.
Okay, that came out wrong. Friends don't let friends keep calling their exes and hanging up. Seriously, you have to stop.
Alec looked furious. So you broke my brand new phone. Thanks a lot.
Jace smiled serenely and lay back on the rock.
You're welcome.
Look on the bright side, Isabel said. You won't be able to get texts from Mum anymore. She's texted me 6 times today. I turned my phone off. She patted her pocket with a significant look.
What does she want? Simon asked.
Constant meetings, Isabel said. Depositions. The Clave keeps wanting to hear what happened when we fought Sebastian at the Burren. We've all had to give accounts like 50 times. How Jace absorbed the heavenly fire from Glorious. Descriptions of the Dark Shadow Hunters, the Infernal Cup, the weapons they used, the runes that were on them, what we were wearing, what Sebastian was wearing, what everyone was wearing. Like phone sex, but boring.
Simon made a choking noise.
What we think Sebastian wants, Alec added. When he'll come back, what he'll do when he does.
Clary leaned her elbows on her knees.
Always good to know the Clave has a well-thought-out and reliable plan.
They don't want to believe it, said Jace, staring at the sky.
That's the problem. No matter how many times we tell them what we saw at the Burren, no matter how many times we tell them how dangerous the Indarkand are, they don't want to believe that Nephilim could really be corrupted, that Shadowhunters could kill Shadowhunters.
Clary had been there when Sebastian had created the first of the Indarkand. She had seen the blankness in their eyes, the fury with which they fought. They terrified her.
They're not shadow hunters anymore, she added in a low voice.
They're not people.
It's hard to believe that if you haven't seen it, Alex said. And Sebastian has only so many of them. A small force, scattered. They don't want to believe he's really a threat. Or if he is a threat, they'd rather believe it was more a threat to us, to New York, than to shadow hunters at large.
They're not wrong that if Sebastian cares about anything, it's about Clary, Jace said, and Clary felt a cold shiver at her spine, a mixture of disgust and apprehension.
He doesn't really have emotions, not like we do. But if he did, he'd have them about her. And he has them about Jocelyn. He hates her.
He paused, thoughtful.
But I don't think he'd be likely to strike directly here. Too obvious.
I hope you told the Clave this, Simon said.
About 1,000 times, said Jace. I don't think they hold my insights in particularly high regard.
Clary looked down at her hands. She had been deposed by the Clave, just like the rest of them. She'd given answers to all their questions. There were still things about Sebastian she hadn't told them. Hadn't told anyone. The things he'd said he wanted from her. She hadn't dreamed much since they'd come back from the Burren with Jace's veins full of fire. But when she did have nightmares, they were about her brother.
It's like trying to fight a ghost, Jace said. They can't track Sebastian, they can't find him, they can't find the shadow hunters he's turned.
They're doing what they can, Alex said. They're shoring up the wards around Idris and Alicante. All the wards, in fact. They've sent dozens of experts to Wrangle Island. Wrangle Island was the seat of all the world's wards, the spells that protected the globe, and Idris in particular, from demons and demon invasion. The network of wards wasn't perfect, and demons slipped through sometimes anyway. But Clary could only imagine how bad the situation would get if the wards didn't exist.
I heard Mum say that the warlocks of the Spiral Labyrinth have been looking for a way to reverse the effects of the Infernal Cup, said Isabel. Of course it would be easier if they had bodies to study.
She trailed off.
Clary knew why. The bodies of the Dark Shadow Hunters killed at the Burren had been brought back to the Bone City for the Silent Brothers to examine. The brothers had never gotten the chance. Overnight, the bodies had rotted away to the equivalent of decade-old corpses. There had been nothing to do but burn the remains.
Isabel found her voice again.
And the Iron Sisters are churning out weapons. We're getting thousands more seraph blades, swords, chakrams, everything forged in heavenly fire.
She looked at Jace. In the days immediately following the battle at the Burren, when the fire had raged through Jace's veins violently enough to make him scream sometimes with the pain, the Silent Brothers had examined him over and over, had tested him with ice and flame, with blessed metal and cold iron, trying to see if there was some way to draw the fire out of him to contain it. They hadn't found one. The fire of Glorious, having once been captured in a blade, seemed in no hurry to inhabit another, or indeed to leave Jace's body for any kind of vessel. Brother Zachariah had told Clary that in the earliest days of Shadowhunters, the Nephilim had sought to capture heavenly fire in a weapon, something that could be wielded against demons. They had never managed it, and eventually seraph blades had become their weapons of choice. In the end, again, the Silent Brothers had given up. Glorious's fire lay curled in Jace's veins like a serpent, and the best he could hope for was to control it so that it didn't destroy him. The loud beep of a text message sounded. Isabel had flicked on her phone again.
Mum says to get back to the Institute now, she said. There's some meeting, we have to be at it.
She stood up, brushing dirt from her dress. I'd invite you back, she said to Simon, but you know, banned for being undead and all.
I did remember that, Simon said, getting to his feet.
Clary scrambled up and reached a hand down to Jace. He took it and stood.
Simon and I are going Christmas shopping, she said. And none of you can come because we have to get you presents.
Alec looked horrified.
Oh God, does that mean I have to get you guys presents?
Clary shook her head.
Don't shadow hunters do, you know, Christmas?
She thought back suddenly to the rather distressing Thanksgiving dinner at Luke's when Jace, on being asked to carve the turkey, had laid into the bird with a sword until there had been little left but turkey flakes.
Maybe not?
We exchange gifts, we honor the change of the seasons, said Isabel. There used to be a winter celebration of the angel. It observed the day that the mortal instruments were given to Jonathan Shadowhunter. I think Shadowhunters got annoyed with being left out of all the mundane celebrations, though, so a lot of institutes have Christmas parties. The London one is famous, she shrugged. I just don't think we're going to do it this year. Oh. Clary felt awful. Of course they didn't want to celebrate Christmas after losing Max. Well, let us get you presents at least. There doesn't have to be a party or anything like that. Exactly. Simon threw his arms up. I have to buy Hanukkah presents. It's mandated by Jewish law. The God of the Jews is an angry God, and very gift-oriented. Clary smiled at him. He was finding it easier and easier to say the word God these days. Jace sighed and kissed Clary, a quick goodbye brush of lips against her temple, but it made her shiver. Not being able to touch Jace or kiss him properly was starting to make her jump out of her own skin. She'd promised him it would never matter, that she'd love him even if they could never touch again, but she hated it anyway. Hated missing the reassurance of the way they had always fit together physically. See you later, Jace said. I'm going to head back with Alec and Izzy. No, you're not, Isabel said unexpectedly. You broke Alec's phone. Granted, we've all been wanting to do that for weeks. Isabel, Alec said. But the fact is, you're his parabatai, and you're the only one who hasn't been to see Magnus. Go talk to him. And tell him what? Jay said. You can't talk people into not breaking up with you. Or maybe you can, he added hastily at Alec's expression. Who can say? I'll give it a try. Thanks, Alec clapped Jace on the shoulder. I've heard you can be charming when you want to be. I've heard the same, Jay said, breaking into a backward jog. He was even graceful doing that, Clary thought gloomily. And sexy, definitely sexy. She lifted her hand in a half-hearted wave. See you later, she called. If I'm not dead from frustration by then. The Freys had never been a religiously observant family, but Clary loved Fifth Avenue at Christmas time. The air smelled like sweet roasted chestnuts and the window displays sparkled with silver and blue, green and red. This year, there were fat, round, crystal snowflakes attached to each lamppost, sending back the winter sunlight in shafts of gold. Not to mention the huge tree at Rockefeller Center. It threw its shadow across them when she and Simon draped themselves over the gate at the side of the skating rink, watching tourists fall down as they tried to navigate the ice. Clary had a hot chocolate wrapped in her hands, the warmth spreading through her body. She felt almost normal. This, coming to Fifth to see the window displays and the tree, had been a winter tradition for her and Simon for as long as she could remember. Feels like old times, doesn't it? He said, echoing her thoughts as he propped his chin on his folded arms. She chanced a sideways look at him. He was wearing a black top coat and scarf that emphasized the pallor of his skin. His eyes were shadowed, indicating that he hadn't fed on blood recently. He looked like what he was, a hungry, tired vampire. Well, she thought, almost like old times. More people to buy presents for, she said. Plus the always traumatic what to buy someone for the first Christmas after you started dating question. What to get the shadow hunter who has everything, Simon said with a grin. Jace mostly likes weapons, Clary said. He likes books, but they have a huge library at the Institute. He likes classical music? She brightened. Simon was a musician, even though his band was terrible and was always changing their name. Currently, they were Lethal Soufflé. He did have training. What would you give someone who likes to play the piano? A piano. Simon. A really huge metronome that could also double as a weapon? Clary sighed, exasperated. Sheet music. Rachmaninoff is tough stuff, but he likes a challenge. Good idea. I'm going to see if there's a music store around here. Clary, done with her hot chocolate, tossed the cup into a nearby trash can and pulled her phone out. What about you? What are you giving Isabel? I have absolutely no idea, Simon said. They had started heading towards the avenue, where a steady stream of pedestrians gawking at the windows clogged the streets. Oh, come on, Isabel's easy. That's my girlfriend you're talking about, Simon's brows drew together. I think, I'm not sure, we haven't discussed it. The relationship, I mean. You really have to DTR, Simon. What? Define the relationship, what it is, where it's going. Are you boyfriend and girlfriend, just having fun? It's complicated, or what? When's she going to tell her parents? Are you allowed to see other people? Simon blanched. What, seriously? Seriously. In the meantime, perfume. Clary grabbed Simon by the back of his coat and hauled him into a cosmetic store. It was massive on the inside, with rows of gleaming bottles everywhere. And something unusual, she said, heading for the fragrance area. Isabel isn't going to want to smell like everyone else. She's going to want to smell like figs or vetiver or... Figs? Figs have a smell? Simon looked horrified. Clary was about to laugh at him when her phone buzzed. It was her mother. Where are you? Clary rolled her eyes and texted back. Jocelyn still got nervous when she thought Clary was out with Jace. Even though, as Clary had pointed out, Jace was probably the safest boyfriend in the world since he was pretty much banned from 1. Getting angry, 2. Making sexual advances, and 3. Doing anything that would produce an adrenaline rush. On the other hand, he had been possessed. She and her mother had both watched while he stood by and let Sebastian threaten Luke. Clary still hadn't talked about everything she'd seen in the apartment she'd shared with Jason Sebastian for that brief time out of time, a mixture of dream and nightmare. She'd never told her mother that Jace had killed someone. There were things Jocelyn didn't need to know, things Clary didn't want to face herself. There is so much in this store I can picture Magnus wanting, Simon said, picking up a glass bottle of body glitter suspended in some kind of oil. Is it against some kind of rule to buy presents for someone who broke up with your friend? I guess it depends. Is Magnus your closer friend or Alec? Alec remembers my name, said Simon, and he set the bottle back down. And I feel bad for him. I understand why Magnus did it, but Alec is so wrecked. I feel like if someone loves you, they should forgive you if you're really sorry. I think it depends what you did, Clary said. I don't mean Alec, I just mean in general. I'm sure Isabel would forgive you for anything, she added hastily. Simon looked dubious. Hold still, she announced, wielding a bottle near his head. In 3 minutes, I'm going to smell your neck. Well, I never, said Simon. You've waited a long time to make your move, Frey, I'll say that for you. Clary didn't bother with a smart retort. She was still thinking of what Simon had said about forgiveness and remembering someone else's voice and face and eyes. Sebastian sitting across from her at a table in Paris. Do you think you can forgive me? I mean, do you think forgiveness is possible for someone like me? There are things you can never forgive, she said. I can never forgive Sebastian. You don't love him. No, but he's my brother. If things were different... But they're not different. Clary abandoned the thought and leaned in to inhale instead. You smell like figs and apricots. Do you really think Isabel wants to smell like a dried fruit plate? Maybe not. Clary picked up another bottle. So what are you going to do? When? Clary looked up from pondering the question of how a tube rose was different from a regular rose to see Simon looking at her with puzzlement in his brown eyes. She said, Well, you can't live with Jordan forever, right? There's college. You're not going to college, he said. No, but I'm a shadow hunter. We keep studying after 18. We get posted to other institutes. That's our college. I don't like the thought of you going away. He shoved his hands into the pockets of his coat. I can't go to college, he said. My mother's not exactly going to pay for it, and I can't take out student loans. I'm legally dead, and besides, how long would it take everyone at school to notice they were getting older, but I wasn't? 16-year-olds don't look like college seniors, I don't know if you've noticed. Clary set the bottle down. Simon, maybe I should get my mom something, he said bitterly. What says thanks for throwing me out of the house and pretending I died? Orchids? But Simon's joking mood had gone. Maybe it's not like old times, he said. I would have gotten you pencils, usually. Art supplies, but you don't draw anymore, do you? Except with your Steely. You don't draw, and I don't breathe. Not so much like last year. Maybe you should talk to Raphael, Clary said. Raphael? He knows how vampires live, Clary said. How they make lives for themselves and how they make money, how they get apartments. He does know those things. He could help.
He could, but he wouldn't, said Simon with a frown. I haven't heard anything from the Dumour bunch since Maureen took over from Camille. I know Raphael is her second in command. I'm pretty sure they still think I have the mark of Cain, otherwise they would have sent someone after me by now. Matter of time.
No, they know not to touch you. It would be war with the Clave. The Institute's been very clear, said Clary. You're protected.
Clary, Simon said, none of us are protected.
Before Clary could answer, she heard someone call out her name. Thoroughly puzzled, she looked over and saw her mother shoving her way through a crowd of shoppers. Through the window, she could see Luke waiting outside on the sidewalk. In his flannel shirt, he looked out of place among the stylish New Yorkers. Breaking free of the crowd, Jocelyn caught up to them and threw her arms around Clary. Clary looked over her mother's shoulder, baffled at Simon. He shrugged. Finally, Jocelyn released her and stepped back. I was so worried something had happened to you.
In Sephora? Clary said. Jocelyn's brow furrowed.
You haven't heard?
I would have thought Jace would have texted you by now.
Clary felt a sudden cold wash through her veins, as if she'd swallowed icy water.
No, what's going on?
I'm sorry, Simon, Jocelyn said, but Clary and I have to get to the Institute right away.
Not much had changed at Magnus's since the first time Jace had been there. The same small entryway and single yellow bulb. Jace used an open rune to get in through the front door, took the stairs two at a time, and buzzed Magnus's apartment bell. Safer than using another rune, he figured. After all, Magnus could be playing video games naked or really doing practically anything. Who knew what warlocks got up to in their spare time? Jace buzzed again, this time leaning firmly on the doorbell. Two more long buzzes, and Magnus finally yanked the door open, looking furious. He was wearing a black silk dressing gown over a white dress shirt and tweed pants. His feet were bare, his dark hair was tangled, and there was the shadow of stubble on his jaw. "What are you doing here?" he demanded. "My, my," said Jace. "So unwelcoming." "That's because you're not welcome." Jace raised an eyebrow. "I thought we were friends." "No, you are Alec's friend. Alec was my boyfriend, so I had to put up with you. But now he's not my boyfriend, so I don't have to put up with you. Not that any of you seem to realize it. You must be the, what, fourth of you lot to bother me?" Magnus counted off on his long fingers. "Clary, Isabel, Simon." "Simon came by." "You seem surprised." "I didn't think he was that invested in your relationship with Alec." "I don't have a relationship with Alec," said Magnus flatly. But Jace had already shouldered past him and was in his living room, looking around curiously. One of the things Jace had always secretly liked about Magnus's apartment was that it rarely looked the same way twice. Sometimes it was a big modern loft, sometimes it looked like a French bordello, or a Victorian opium den, or the inside of a spaceship. Right now, though, it was messy and dark. Stacks of old Chinese food cartons littered the coffee table. Chairman Miao lay on the rag rug, all four legs sticking straight out in front of him like a dead deer. "It smells like hot break in here," said Jace. "That's the Chinese food." Magnus threw himself onto the sofa and stretched out his long legs. "Go on, get it over with. Say whatever you came here to say." "I think you should get back together with Alec," said Jace. Magnus rolled his eyes up to the ceiling. "And why is that?" "Because he's miserable," said Jace. "And he's sorry. He's sorry about what he did. He won't do it again." "Oh, he won't sneak around behind my back with one of my exes planning to shorten my life again? Very noble of him." "Magnus. Besides, Camille's dead. He can't do it again." "You know what I mean," said Jace. "He won't lie to you, or mislead you, or hide things from you, or whatever it is you're actually upset about." He threw himself into a wing-back leather chair and raised an eyebrow. "So?" Magnus rolled onto his side. "What do you care if Alec's miserable?" "What do I care?" Jace said, so loudly that Chairman Miao sat bolt upright as if he'd been shocked. "Of course I care about Alec.
He's my best friend, my Parabatai, and he's unhappy. And so are you, by the look of things. Takeout containers everywhere. You haven't done anything to fix up the place. Your cat looks dead. He's not dead.
I care about Alec, Jace said, fixing Magnus with an unswerving gaze. I care about him more than I care about myself.
Don't you ever think, Magnus mused, pulling at a bit of peeling fingernail polish, that the whole Parabatai business is rather cruel? You can choose your Parabatai, but then you can never unchoose them, even if they turn on you. Look at Luke and Valentine. And though your Parabatai is the closest person in the world to you in some ways, you can't fall in love with them? And if they die, some part of you dies too. How do you know so much about Parabatai?
I know shadow hunters, said Magnus, patting the sofa behind him so that the chairman leaped up onto the cushions and nudged at Magnus with his head. The warlock's long fingers sank into the cat's fur. I have for a long time. You are odd creatures, all fragile nobility and humanity on one side, and all the thoughtless fire of angels on the other. His eyes flicked toward Jace. You especially, Herondale, for you have the fire of angels in your blood.
You've been friends with shadow hunters before?
Friends, said Magnus. What does that mean, really?
You'd know, said Jace.
If you had any.
Do you?
Do you have friends? I mean, besides the people who come to your parties. Most people are afraid of you, or they seem to owe you something, or you slept with them once. But friends, I don't see you having a lot of those.
Well, this is novel, said Magnus. None of the rest of your group has tried insulting me.
Is it working?
If you mean do I suddenly feel compelled to get back together with Alec, no, said Magnus. I have developed an odd craving for pizza, but that might be unrelated.
Alec said you do that, said Jace. Deflect questions about yourself with jokes.
Magnus narrowed his eyes.
And I'm the only one who does that?
Exactly, Jace said. Take it from someone who knows. You hate talking about yourself, and you'd rather make people angry than be pitied.
How old are you, Magnus? The real answer.
Magnus said nothing.
What were your parents' names? Your father's name?
Magnus glared at him out of gold-green eyes.
If I wanted to lie on a couch and complain to someone about my parents, I'd hire a psychiatrist.
Ah, said Jace, but my services are free.
I heard that about you.
Jace grinned and slid down in his chair. There was a pillow with a pattern of the Union Jack on the ottoman. He grabbed it and put it behind his head.
I don't have anywhere to be. I can sit here all day.
Great, Magnus said. I'm going to take a nap. He reached out for a crumpled blanket lying on the floor, just as Jace's phone rang. Magnus watched, arrested mid-motion, as Jace dug around in his pocket and flipped the phone open. It was Isabel.
Jace?
Yeah, I'm at Magnus's place. I think I might be making some headway. What's up?
Come back, Isabel said, and Jace sat up straight, the pillow tumbling to the floor. Her voice was tightly strained. He could hear the sharpness in it, like the off notes of a badly tuned piano.
To the Institute, right away, Jace.
What is it?
He asked. What's happened?
And he saw Magnus sit up too, the blanket dropping from his hand.
Sebastian, Isabel said.
Jace closed his eyes. He saw golden blood and white feathers scattered across a marble floor. He remembered the apartment, a knife in his hands, the world at his feet, Sebastian's grip on his wrist, those fathomless black eyes looking at him with dark amusement. There was a buzzing in his ears.
What is it? Magnus's voice cut through Jace's thoughts. He realized he was already at the door, the phone back in his pocket. He turned. Magnus was behind him, his expression stark.
Is it Alec? Is he all right?
What do you care? Said Jace, and Magnus flinched. Jace didn't think he'd ever seen Magnus flinch before. It was the only thing that kept Jace from slamming the door on the way out. There were dozens of unfamiliar coats and jackets hanging in the entryway of the Institute. Clary felt the tight buzzing of tension in her shoulders as she unzipped her own wool coat and hung it on one of the hooks that lined the walls. "And Maris didn't say what this was about?" Clary demanded. The edges of her voice had been rubbed thin by anxiety. Jocelyn had unwound a long gray scarf from around her neck and barely looked as Luke took it from her to drape it on a hook. Her green eyes were darting around the room, taking in the gate of the elevator, the arched ceiling overhead, the faded murals of men and angels. Luke shook his head. Just that there'd been an attack on the Clave, and we needed to get here as quickly as possible. "It's the wee pot that concerns me." Jocelyn wound her hair up into a knot at the back of her head and secured it with her fingers. "I haven't been in an institute in years. Why do they want me here?" Luke squeezed her shoulder reassuringly. Clary knew what Jocelyn feared, what they all feared. The only reason the Clave would want Jocelyn here was if there was news of her son. "Maris said they'd be in the library," Jocelyn said. Clary led the way. She could hear Luke and her mother talking behind her, and the soft sound of their footsteps, Luke slower than they had once been. He hadn't entirely recovered from the injury that had nearly killed him in November. "You know why you're here, don't you?" breathed the soft voice in the back of her head. She knew it wasn't really there, but that didn't help. She hadn't seen her brother since the fight at the Burren, but she carried him in some small part of her mind, an intrusive, unwelcome ghost. "Because of me, you always knew I hadn't gone away forever. I told you what would happen. I spelled it out for you. Erhome. I am coming." They had reached the library, the door was half open, and a babel of voices spilled through. Jocelyn paused for a moment, her expression tight. Clary put her hand on the doorknob. "Are you ready?" She hadn't noticed till then what her mother was wearing. Black jeans, boots, and a black turtleneck. As if without thinking about it, she had put on the closest thing she had to fighting gear. Jocelyn nodded at her daughter. Someone had pushed back all the furniture in the library, clearing a large space in the middle of the room, just atop the mosaic of the angel. A massive table had been placed there, a huge slab of marble balanced on top of two kneeling stone angels. Around the table were seated the conclave. Some members, like Kadir and Maris, Clary knew by name. Others were just familiar faces. Maris was standing, ticking off names on her fingers as she chanted aloud. "Berlin," she said, "no survivors. Bangkok, no survivors. Moscow, no survivors. Los Angeles." "Los Angeles," said Jocelyn. "That was the Blackthorns, are they?" Maris looked startled, as if she hadn't realized Jocelyn had come in. Her blue eyes swept over Luke and Clary. She looked drawn and exhausted. Her hair scraped back severely, a stain, red wine or blood, on the sleeve of her tailored jacket. "There were survivors," she said. "Children, they're in Idris now." "Helen," said Alec, and Clary thought of the girl who had fought with them against Sebastian at the Burren. She remembered her in the nave of the Institute, a dark-haired boy clinging to her wrist. "My brother Julian." "Aline's girlfriend," Clary blurted out, and saw the conclave look at her with thinly veiled hostility. They always did, as if who she was and what she represented made them almost unable to see her. Valentine's daughter. Valentine's daughter. "Is she all right?" "She was in Idris with Aline," said Maris. "Her younger brothers and sisters survived, although there seems to have been an issue with the eldest brother, Mark." "An issue," said Luke. "What's going on exactly, Maris?" "I don't think we'll know the whole story until we get to Idris," said Maris, smoothing back her already smooth hair. "But there have been attacks, several in the course of 2 nights, on 6 institutes. We're not sure yet how the institutes were breached, but we know..." "Sebastian," said Clary's mother. She had her hands jammed into the pockets of her black trousers, but Clary suspected that if she hadn't, Clary would have been able to see that her mother's hands were tightened into fists. "Cut to the point, Maris, my son. You wouldn't have called me here if he wasn't responsible, would you?" Jocelyn's eyes met Maris's, and Clary wondered if this was how it had been when they'd both been in the circle, the sharp edges of their personalities rubbing up against each other, causing sparks. Before Maris could speak, the door opened and Jace came in. He was flushed with the cold, bareheaded, fair hair tousled by the wind. His hands were gloveless, red at the tips from the weather, scarred with marks new and old. He saw Clary and gave her a quick smile before settling into a chair propped against the wall. Luke, as usual, moved to make peace. Maris, is Sebastian responsible? Maris took a deep breath. Yes, yes he was, and he had the Indocant with him. Of course it's Sebastian, said Isabel. She had been staring down at the table. Now she raised her head. Her face was a mask of hatred and rage. He said he was coming. Well, now he's come. Maris sighed. We assumed he'd attack Idris. That was what all the intelligence indicated. Not institutes. So he did the thing you didn't expect, said Jace. He always does the thing you don't expect. Maybe the Clave should plan for that. Jace's voice dropped. I told you he'd want more soldiers. Jace, said Maris, you're not helping. I wasn't trying to. I would have thought he'd attack here first, said Alec, given what Jace was saying before, and it's true. Everyone he loves or hates is here. He doesn't love anyone, Jocelyn snapped. Mom, stop, Clary said. Her heart was pounding, sick in her chest. Yet at the same time, there was a strange sense of relief. All this time waiting for Sebastian to come, and now he had. Now the waiting was over. Now the war would start. So what are we supposed to do? Fortify the Institute? Hide? Let me guess, said Jace, his voice dripping sarcasm. The Claves called for a council, another meeting. The Clave has called for immediate evacuation, said Maris. And at that, everyone went silent, even Jace. All institutes are to empty out. All conclaves must return to Alicante. The wards around Idris will be doubled after tomorrow. No one will be able to come in or get out. Isabel swallowed. When do we leave New York? Maris straightened up. Some of her usual imperious air was back. Her mouth a thin line, her jaw set with determination. Go and pack, she said. We leave tonight.
2. Stand or fall. Waking was like being plunged into a bath of icy water. Emma sat up straight, torn out of her sleep, her mouth opening on a scream. Jules! Jules! There was movement in the darkness, a hand on her arm, and a sudden light that stung her eyes. Emma gasped and scrabbled backward, pushing herself among the cushions. She was lying on a bed, she realized, pillows stacked behind her back and the sheets twisted around her body in a sweaty tangle. She blinked the darkness out of her eyes, trying to focus. Helen Blackthorn was leaning over her, blue-green eyes worried, a witchlight glowing in her hand. They were in a room with a steeply gabled roof, slanting down hard on either side, like in a fairy tale cabin. A big four-poster wooden bed was in the center of the room, and in the shadows behind Helen, Emma could see furniture looming. A big square wardrobe, a long sofa, a table with rickety legs. Where am I? Emma gasped. Idris, Helen said, stroking her arm in a soothing manner. You made it to Idris, Emma. We're in the attic of the Penhallows' house. My parents... Emma's teeth chattered. Where are my parents? You came through the portal with Julian, said Helen gently, not answering her question. All of you made it through somehow. It's a miracle, you know. The Clave opened the way, but portal travel is hard. Drew came through holding on to Tavi, and the twins came through together, of course. And then, when we'd almost given up hope, you two. You were unconscious, Em. She brushed Emma's hair back from her forehead. We were so worried, you should have seen Jules. What's happening? Emma demanded. She pulled back from Helen's touch, not because she didn't like Helen, but because her heart was pounding. What about Mark and Mr. Blackthorn? Helen hesitated.
Sebastian Morgenstern has attacked 6 institutes over the past few days. He's either killed everyone or turned them. He can use the Infernal Cup to make Shadow Hunters not themselves anymore.
I saw him do it, Emma whispered.
To Katarina, and he turned your father too. They were going to do it to Mark, but Sebastian said he didn't want him because he had fairy blood.
Helen flinched.
We have reason to think Mark's still alive, she said. They were able to track him to a point where he disappeared, but the runes indicate he's not dead. It's possible that Sebastian may be holding him hostage.
My parents, Emma said again, through a drier throat this time. She knew what it meant that Helen hadn't answered her question the first time she'd asked it. Where are they? They weren't in the Institute, so Sebastian couldn't have hurt them. Helen exhaled. She looked young suddenly, almost as young as Jules. Sebastian doesn't just attack institutes. He murders or takes Conclave members from their own homes. Your parents, the Clave tried to track them, but they couldn't. Then their bodies washed up in Marina del Rey on the beach this morning. The Clave doesn't know what happened exactly, but...
Helen's voice trailed off into a meaningless string of words. Words such as positive identification, and scars and markings on the bodies, and no evidence recovered. Things like in the water for hours, and no way to transport the corpses. And given all the proper funeral rites burned on the beach as they have both requested, you understand. Emma screamed. It was a scream with no words at first, rising higher and higher, a scream that tore her throat and brought the taste of metal into her mouth. It was a scream of loss so immense there was no speech for it. It was the wordless cry of having the sky over your head, the air in your lungs ripped away from you forever. She screamed and screamed again and tore at the mattress with her hands until she gouged through it. And there were feathers and blood stuck under her fingernails, and Helen was sobbing, trying to hold her, saying, "Emma, Emma, please, Emma, please." And then there was more illumination. Someone had turned on a lantern in the room, and Emma heard her name, in a soft, urgent, familiar voice, and Helen let her go, and there was Jules, leaning against the edge of the bed and holding something out to her, something that gleamed gold in the new harsh light. It was Cortana, unsheathed, lying bare across his palms like an offering. Emma thought she was still screaming, but she took the sword, the words flashing across the blade, burning across her eyes. "I am Cortana, of the same steel and temper as Joyeuse and Durandal." She heard her father's voice in her head. "Carstairs have carried this sword for generations. The inscription reminds us that Shadow Hunters are the angels' weapons. Temper us in the fire and we grow stronger. When we suffer, we survive." Emma choked, pushing back on the screams, forcing them down and into silence. This was what her father had meant. Like Cortana, she had steel in her veins and she was meant to be strong. Even if her parents were not there to see it, she would be strong for them. She hugged the sword against her chest. As if from a distance, she heard Helen exclaim and reach for her. But Julian, who always knew what Emma needed, tugged Helen's hand back. Emma's fingers were around the blade, and blood was running down her arms and chest where the tip sliced at her collarbone. She didn't feel it. Rocking back and forth, she clutched the sword like it was the only thing she had ever loved, and let the blood spill down instead of tears.
Simon couldn't quite shake a feeling of déjà vu. He'd been here before, standing just outside the Institute, watching the Lightwoods disappear through a shimmering portal. Though then, back before he had ever borne the mark of Cain, the portal had been created by Magnus, and this time it was under the oversight of a blue-skinned warlock woman named Katarina Loss. That time, he'd been summoned because Jace had wanted to talk to him about Clary before he disappeared into another country. This time, Clary was disappearing with them. He felt her hand on his, her fingers lightly wringing his wrist. The whole of the Conclave, nearly every Shadow Hunter in New York City, had come through the gates of the Institute
and pass through the shimmering portal. The Lightwoods, as guardians of the Institute, would go last. Simon had been here since the start of twilight. Bars of red sky sliding down behind the buildings of the New York skyline. And now Witchlight lit the scene in front of him, picking out small glimmering details. Isabel's whip, the spark of fire that jumped from Alec's family ring as he gestured, the glints in Jace's pale hair. "It looks different," Simon said. Clary looked up at him. Like the rest of the Shadow Hunters, she was dressed in what Simon could only describe as a cloak. It seemed to be what they broke out during cold winter weather, made of a heavy, velvety black material that buckled across the chest. He wondered where she'd gotten it. Maybe they just issued them. "What does?" "The portal," he said. "It looks different from when Magnus did it. More blue. Maybe they all have different senses of style." Simon looked over at Katerina. She seemed briskly efficient, like a hospital nurse or a kindergarten teacher. Definitely not like Magnus. "How's Izzy?" "Worried, I think. Everyone's worried." There was a short silence. Clary exhaled, her breath floating white on the winter air. "I don't like you going," Simon said, at exactly the same time that Clary said, "I don't like going and leaving you here." "I'll be fine," Simon said. "I have Jordan looking after me." Indeed, Jordan was there, sitting on top of the wall that ran around the Institute and looking watchful. "And no one's tried to kill me in at least 2 weeks." "Not funny," Clary scowled. The problem, Simon reflected, was that it was difficult to reassure someone that you'd be fine when you were a daylighter. Some vampires might want Simon on their side, eager to benefit from his unusual powers. Camille had attempted to recruit him, and others might try. But Simon had the distinct impression that the vast majority of vampires wanted to kill him. "I'm pretty sure Maureen's still hoping to get her hands on me," Simon said. Maureen was the head of the New York vampire clan, and believed that she was in love with Simon, which would have been less awkward if she hadn't been 13 years old. "I know the Clave warned people not to touch me, but..." "Maureen wants to touch you," Clary said with a sideways grin. "Bad touch." "Silence, Frey." "Jordan will keep her off you." Simon looked ahead meditatively. He had been trying not to stare at Isabel, who had greeted him with only a brief wave since he'd arrived at the Institute. She was helping her mother, her black hair flying in the brisk wind. "You could just go up and talk to her," Clary said, "instead of staring like a creeper." "I'm not staring like a creeper. I'm staring subtly." "I noticed," Clary pointed out. "Look, you know how Isabel gets. When she's upset, she withdraws. She won't talk to anyone but Jace or Alec, because she hardly trusts anyone. But if you're going to be her boyfriend, you have to show her you're one of those people she can trust." "I'm not her boyfriend. At least, I don't think I'm her boyfriend. She's never used the word boyfriend anyway." Clary kicked him in the ankle. "You two need to DTR more than any other people I've ever met." "Defining relationships over here?" said a voice from behind them. Simon turned and saw Magnus, very tall against the dark sky behind them. He was soberly dressed, jeans and a black t-shirt, his dark hair partly in his eyes. "I see that even as the world plunges into darkness and peril, you two stand around discussing your love lives. Teenagers." "What are you doing here?" Simon said, too surprised for a smart comeback. "Came to see Alec," Magnus said. Clary raised her eyebrows at him. "What was that about teenagers?" Magnus held up a warning finger. "Don't overstep yourself, Biscuit," he said, and moved past them, disappearing into the crowd around the portal. "Biscuit," said Simon. "Believe it or not, he's called me that before," Clary said. "Simon, look." She turned toward him, tugging his hand out of his jeans pocket. She looked down at it and smiled. "The ring," she said. "Handy when it worked, wasn't it?" Simon looked down as well. A hammered gold ring in the shape of a leaf encircled his right ring finger. It had once been a connection to Clary. Now, with hers destroyed, it was only a ring, but he kept it regardless. He knew it was a little close to having half of a BFF necklace, but he couldn't help it. It was a beautiful object, and still a symbol of the connection between them. She squeezed his hand hard, raising her eyes to his. Shadows moved in the green of her irises. He could tell she was afraid.
"I know it's just a council meeting," Clary started to say, "but you're staying in Idris."
"Only until they can figure out what happened with the institutes and how to protect them," said Clary. "Then we'll come back. I know phones and texting and all that doesn't work in Idris, but if you need to talk to me, tell Magnus. He'll find a way to get me a message."
Simon felt his throat tighten.
"Clary,
I love you," she said. "You're my best friend."
She let go of his hand, her eyes shining.
"No, don't say anything. I don't want you to say anything."
She turned and almost ran back toward the portal, where Jocelyn and Luke were waiting for her, three packed duffel bags at their feet. Luke glanced across the courtyard at Simon, his expression thoughtful.
But where was Isabel?
The crowd of shadow hunters had thinned. Jace had moved to stand beside Clary, his hand on her shoulder. Maris was near the portal, but Isabel, who had been with her...
"Simon," said a voice at his shoulder, and he turned to see Izzy, her face a pale smudge between dark hair and dark cloak, looking at him, her expression half angry, half sad.
"I guess this is the part where we say goodbye."
"Okay," Magnus said. "You wanted to talk to me, so talk."
Alec looked at him, wide-eyed. They had gone around the side of the church and were standing in a small winter-burned garden, among leafless hedges. Thick vines covered the stone wall and rusted gate nearby, now so denuded by winter that Alec could see the mundane street through the gaps in the iron door. A stone bench was nearby, its rough surface crusted with ice.
"I wanted..."
"What?" Magnus looked at him darkly, as if he had done something stupid. Alec suspected that he had. His nerves were jangling together like wind chimes, and he had a sick feeling in the pit of his stomach. The last time he had seen Magnus, the warlock had been walking away from him, vanishing into a disused subway tunnel, getting smaller and smaller until he disappeared. "Aku Shinta Kamu," he'd said to Alec. "I love you" in Indonesian. It had given Alec a spark of hope, enough that he'd called Magnus dozens of times, enough to keep him checking his phone, checking the mail, even checking the windows of his room, which seemed strange and empty and unfamiliar without Magnus in it, not his room at all, for magically delivered notes or messages. And now Magnus was standing in front of him, with his raggedy black hair and slit-pupiled cat eyes, and his voice like dark molasses, and his cool, sharp, beautiful face that gave nothing whatsoever away, and Alec felt like he had swallowed glue.
"Wanted to talk to me," Magnus said. "I assume that was the meaning of all those phone calls, and why you sent all your stupid friends over to my apartment. Or do you just do that to everyone?"
Alec swallowed against the dryness in his throat and said the first thing that came into his head.
"Aren't you ever going to forgive me?"
"I..." Magnus broke off and looked away, shaking his head.
"Alec, I have forgiven you."
"It doesn't seem like it. You seem angry." When Magnus looked back at him, it was with a gentler expression.
"I'm worried about you," he said. "The attacks on the institutes. I just heard."
Alec felt dizzy. Magnus forgave him. Magnus was worried about him.
"Did you know we were leaving for Idris?"
"Katerina told me she'd been summoned to make a portal."
"I guessed," Magnus said wryly.
"I was a little surprised you hadn't called or texted to tell me you were going away."
"Well, you never answer my calls or texts," said Alec.
"That hasn't stopped you before."
"Everyone gives up eventually," Alec said.
"Besides, Jace broke my phone." Magnus huffed out a breath of laughter.
"Oh, Alexander."
"What?"
Alec asked, honestly puzzled.
You're so...
"I really want to kiss you," Magnus said abruptly, and then shook his head.
"See, this is why I haven't been willing to see you."
"But you're here now," Alec said.
He remembered the first time Magnus had ever kissed him, against the wall outside his apartment, and all his bones had turned to liquid, and he thought,
"Oh, right. This is what it's supposed to be like."
I get it now.
You could.
I can't, Magnus said. It's not working. It wasn't working. You have to see that, don't you? His hands were on Alec's shoulders. Alec could feel Magnus's thumb brush against his neck, over his collar, and his whole body jumped. Don't you? Magnus said, and kissed him. Alec leaned into the kiss. It was utterly quiet. He heard the crunch of his boots on the snowy ground as he moved forward, Magnus's hand sliding around to steady the back of his neck, and Magnus tasted like he always did, sweet and bitter and familiar. And Alec parted his lips to gasp or breathe Magnus in, but it was too late because Magnus broke away from him with a wrench and stepped backward and it was over.
What?
Alec said, feeling stunned and strangely diminished.
Magnus, what?
I shouldn't have done that, Magnus said all in a rush. He was clearly agitated in a way Alec had rarely seen him, a flush along his high cheekbones.
I forgive you, but I can't be with you. I can't. It doesn't work.
I'm going to live forever, or at least until someone finally kills me, and you're not. And it's too much for you to take on.
Don't tell me what's too much for me, said Alec with deadly flatness.
Magnus so rarely looked surprised that the expression seemed almost foreign on his face. It's too much for most people, he said, most mortals, and not easy on us either. Watching someone you love age and die. I knew a girl once, a mortal like me.
And she was with someone mortal? Said Alec.
What happened?
He died, Magnus said.
There was a finality to the way that he said it that spoke of a deeper grief than words could paint. His cat's eyes shone in the dark. I don't know why I thought this would ever work, he said. I'm sorry, Alec. I shouldn't have come.
No, Alec said. You shouldn't.
Magnus was looking at Alec a little warily, as if he had approached someone familiar on the street only to find out they were a stranger.
I don't know why you did, Alec said.
I know I've been torturing myself for weeks now about you, and what I did, and how I shouldn't have done it. Shouldn't ever have talked to Camille. I've been sorry, and I've understood, and I've apologized and apologized, and you haven't ever been there. I did all that without you, so it makes me wonder what else I could do without you. He looked at Magnus meditatively.
It was my fault what happened, but it was your fault too.
I could have learned not to care that you are immortal and I'm mortal. Everyone gets the time they get together and no more. Maybe we're not so different that way. But you know what I can't get past? That you never tell me anything. I don't know when you were born. I don't know anything about your life, what your real name is, or about your family, or what the first face you ever loved was, or the first time your heart was broken. You know everything about me, and I know nothing about you. That's the real problem.
I told you, Magnus said softly, on our first date, that you would have to take me as I came, no questions.
Alec waved that away.
It's not a fair thing to ask, and you know, you knew.
I didn't understand enough about love then to understand that.
You act like you're the wronged party, but you had a hand in this, Magnus.
Yes, Magnus said after a pause. Yes, I suppose I did.
But that doesn't change anything,
Alec said, feeling the cold air stealing under his ribcage.
It never does with you.
I can't change, Magnus said. It's been too long. We petrify, you know, immortals, like fossils turned to stone. I thought when I met you that you had all this wonder and all this joy, and everything was new to you, and I thought it would change me, but...
Change yourself,
Alec said, but it didn't come out angry or stern, as he had intended it, but soft, like a plea. But Magnus only shook his head.
Alec, he said,
you know my dream, the one about the city made of blood, and blood in the streets, and towers of bone. If Sebastian gets what he wants, that will be this world. The blood will be Nephilim blood. Go to Idris. You're safer there.
but don't be trusting, and don't let your guard down. I need you to live, he breathed, and turned around very abruptly and walked away. I need you to live. Alex sat down on the frozen stone bench and put his face in his hands. Not goodbye forever, Simon protested, but Isabel just frowned. Come here, she said, and tugged at his sleeve. She was wearing dark red velvet gloves, and her hand looked like a splash of blood against the navy fabric of his jacket. Simon pushed the thought away. He wished he wouldn't think about blood at inopportune times. Come where? Isabel just rolled her eyes and pulled him sideways into a shadowed alcove near the front gates of the Institute. The space wasn't a large one, and Simon could feel the heat from Isabel's body. Warmth and cold didn't affect him since he'd become a vampire, unless it was the heat of blood. He didn't know if it was because he'd drunk Isabel's blood before, or if it was something deeper, but he was aware of the pulse of blood through her veins the way he was of no one else's. I wish I were coming with you to Idris, he said without preamble. You're safer here, she said, though her dark eyes softened. Besides, we're not going forever. The only downworlders who can go to Alicante are council members, because they're going to have a meeting, figure out what we're all going to do, and probably send us back out. We can't hide in Idris while Sebastian rampages around outside it. Shadowhunters don't do that. He stroked a finger down her cheek. But you want me to hide here? You've got Jordan to watch you here, she said. Your own personal bodyguard. You're Clary's best friend, she added. Sebastian knows that you're hostage material. You should be where he isn't. He's never shown any interest in me before. I don't see why he'd start now. She shrugged, pulling her cloak tighter around herself. He's never shown any interest in anyone but Clary and Jace, but that doesn't mean he won't start. He's not stupid. She said it grudgingly, as if she hated to give Sebastian even that much credit. Clary would do anything for you. She'd do anything for you too, Izzy. And at Isabel's doubtful look, he cupped her cheek. Okay. So if you won't be gone all that long, then what's all this about then? She made a face. Her cheeks and mouth were rosy, the cold bringing the red to the surface. He wished he could press his cold lips to hers, so full of blood and life and warmth. But he was conscious of her parents watching. I heard Clary when she was saying goodbye to you. She said she loved you. Simon stared. Yes, but she didn't mean it that way, Izzy. I know that, Isabel protested. Please, I know that. But it's just that she says it so easily and you say it back so easily. And I've never said it to anyone. Not anyone who wasn't related to me. But if you say it, he said, you could get hurt. That's why you don't. So could you. Her eyes were big and black, reflecting the stars. Get hurt. I could hurt you. I know, Simon said. I know, and I don't care. Jace told me once you'd walk all over my heart in high-heeled boots, and it hasn't stopped me. Isabel gave a little gasp of startled laughter. He said that. And you stuck around. He leaned in toward her. If he had breath, it would have stirred her hair. I would consider it an honor. She turned her head, and their lips brushed together. Hers were achingly warm. She was doing something with her hands. Unfastening her cloak, he thought for a moment. But surely Isabel wasn't about to start taking her clothes off in front of her entire family. Not that Simon was sure he'd have the fortitude to stop her. She was Isabel, after all, and she had almost, almost, said she loved him. Her lips moved against his skin as she spoke. Take this, she whispered. And he felt something cold at the back of his neck, and the smooth glide of velvet as she drew back and her gloves brushed his throat. He glanced down. Against his chest gleamed a blood-red square, Isabel's ruby pendant. It was a Shadowhunter heirloom, enchanted to detect the presence of demonic energy. I can't take this, he said, shocked. Iz, this must be worth a fortune. She squared her shoulders. It's a loan. not a gift. Keep it until I see you again. She brushed her gloved fingers across the ruby. There's an old story that it came into our family by way of a vampire, so it's fitting. Isabella, don't, she said, cutting him off, though he didn't know exactly what he'd been about to say. Don't say it, not now. She was backing away from him. He could see her family behind her, all that was left of the conclave. Luke had gone through the portal, and Jocelyn was in the middle of following him. Alec, coming around the side of the Institute with his hands in his pockets, glanced over at Isabel and Simon, raised an eyebrow, and kept walking.
Just don't date anyone else while I'm gone, okay?
He stared after her.
Does that mean we're dating? He said.
But she only quirked a smile, and then turned and dashed toward the portal. He saw her take Alec's hand, and they stepped through together. Maris followed, and then Jace, and then finally, Clary was the last, standing beside Katarina, framed by sizzling blue light. She winked at Simon and stepped through. He saw the whirl of the portal as it caught her, and then she was gone. Simon put his hand to the ruby at his throat. He thought he could feel a beat inside the stone, a shifting pulse. It was almost like having a heart again.
3. Birds to the Mountain. Clary set her bag down by the door and looked around. She could hear her mother and Luke moving around her, putting down their own luggage, turning on the witch lights that illuminated Armitage's house. Clary braced herself. They still had little idea how Armitage had been taken by Sebastian. Though the place had already been examined by council members for dangerous materials, Clary knew her brother. If the mood had taken him, he would have destroyed everything in the house, just to show that he could. Turned the sofas to kindling, shattered the glass in the mirrors, blown the windows to smithereens. She heard her mother give a small exhale of relief and knew Jocelyn must have been thinking what Clary was. Whatever had happened, the house looked fine. There was nothing in it to indicate that harm had come to Armitage. Books were stacked on the coffee table, the floors were dusty but uncluttered. The photographs on the walls were straight. Clary saw with a pang that there was a recent photograph near the fireplace of her, Luke, and Jocelyn at Coney Island, arms around one another smiling. She thought of the last time she had seen Luke's sister, Sebastian, forcing Armitage to drink from the infernal cup as she screamed in protest. The way the personality had faded out of her eyes after she had swallowed its contents. Clary wondered if that was what it was like to watch someone die. Not that she hadn't seen death, too. Valentine had died in front of her. Surely she was too young to have so many ghosts. Luke had moved to look at the fireplace and the photos hanging around it. He reached out to touch one that showed two blue-eyed children. One of them, the younger boy, was drawing, while his sister looked on, her expression fond. Luke looked exhausted. Their portal travel had taken them to the guard, and they had walked down through the city to Armitage's house. Luke still winced often from the pain of the wound in his side that hadn't quite healed, but Clary doubted the injury was what was affecting him. The quiet in Armitage's house. The homey rag rugs on the floor, the carefully arranged personal mementos. Everything spoke of an ordinary life, interrupted in the most terrible way possible. Jocelyn moved over to put her hand on Luke's shoulder, murmuring soothingly. He turned in the circle of her arms, putting his head against her shoulder. It was more comforting than in any way romantic, but Clary still felt as if she had stumbled on a private moment. Soundlessly, she plucked up her duffel bag and made her way up the stairs. The spare room hadn't changed. Small, the walls painted white, the windows like portholes, circular. There was the window Jace had crawled through one night, and the same colorful quilt on the bed. She dropped her bag onto the floor near the nightstand. The nightstand where Jace had left a letter in the morning telling her he was going and he wasn't coming back. She sat down on the edge of the bed, trying to shake off the web of memories. She hadn't realized how hard it would be to be back in Idris. New York was home, normal. Idris was war and devastation. In Idris, she had seen death for the first time. Her blood was humming, pounding hard in her ears. She wanted to see Jace, to see Alec and Isabel. They would ground her, give her a sense of normalcy. She was able, very faintly, to hear her mother and Luke moving around downstairs, possibly even the clink of cups in the kitchen. She swung herself off the bed and went to the foot, where a square trunk rested. It was the trunk Armitis had brought up for her when she had been here before, telling her to go through it to find clothes. She knelt down now and opened it, the same clothes carefully packed away between layers of paper, school uniforms, practical sweaters and jeans, more formal shirts and skirts, and beneath that, a dress Clary had first thought was a wedding gown. She drew it out. Now that she was more familiar with Shadowhunters and their world, she recognized it for what it was. Morning clothes. A white dress, simple. The close-fitting jacket, with silver morning runes worked into the material. And there, the cuffs, an almost invisible design of birds. Herons. Clary laid the clothes carefully on the bed. She could see, in her mind's eye, Armitis wearing these clothes when Stephen Herondale had died. Putting them on carefully, smoothing down the fabric, buttoning the jacket clothes, all to mourn a man to whom she'd no longer been married. Widow's clothes for someone who had not been able to call herself a widow. Clary? It was her mother leaning in the doorway, watching her. What are those? Oh. She crossed the room, touched the fabric of the dress and sighed. Oh, Armitis. She never did get over Stephen, did she? Asked Clary. Sometimes people don't. Jocelyn's hand moved from the dress to Clary's hair, tucked it back with quick motherly precision. And Nephilim, we do tend to love very overwhelmingly. To fall in love only once, to die of grief over love. My old tutor used to say that the hearts of Nephilim were like the hearts of angels. They felt every human pain and never healed. But you did. You loved Valentine, but now you love Luke. I know. Jocelyn's look was far away. It wasn't until I spent more time in the mundane world that I started to realize that it wasn't how most human beings thought of love. I realized that you might have it more than once, that your heart could heal, that you could love over and over again. And I always loved Luke. I might not have known it, but I always did love him. Jocelyn pointed at the clothes on the bed. You should wear the morning jacket, she said, tomorrow. Startled, Clary said, To the meeting? Shadowhunters have died and been turned dark, said Jocelyn. Every Shadowhunter lost is someone's son, brother, sister, cousin. Nephilim are a family. A dysfunctional family, but... She touched her daughter's face, her own expression hidden in the shadows. Get some sleep, Clary, she said. Tomorrow is going to be a long day. After the door shut behind her mother, Clary put on her nightgown and then clambered obediently into bed. She shut her eyes and tried to sleep, but sleep wouldn't come. Images kept bursting behind her eyelids like fireworks, angels falling from the sky, golden blood, ethereal in his chains with his blinded eyes, telling her of the images of runes he had given her through her life, the visions and dreams of the future. She remembered her dreams of her brother with black wings that spilled blood walking across a frozen lake. She threw the coverlet off. She felt hot and itchy, too strung up to sleep. After getting out of bed, she padded downstairs in search of a glass of water. The living room was half-lit, dim witchlight spilling down the corridor. Murmurs came from beyond the door. Someone was awake and talking in the kitchen. Clary moved down the corridor warily, until soft, overheard whispers began to take on shape and familiarity. She recognized her mother's voice first, taut with distress. But I just don't understand how it could have been in the cupboard, she was saying. I haven't seen it since Valentine took everything we owned back in New York. Luke spoke. Didn't Clary say that Jonathan had it? Yes, but then it would have been destroyed with that foul apartment, wouldn't it? Jocelyn's voice rose as Clary moved to stand in the doorway of the kitchen.
The one with the clothes Valentine bought for me as if I were coming back.
Clary stood very still. Her mother and Luke were sitting at the kitchen table. Her mother had her head down on one hand and Luke was rubbing her back. Clary had told her mother everything about the apartment, about how Valentine had maintained it with all Jocelyn's things there, determined that one day his wife would come back and live with him. Her mother had listened calmly, but clearly the story had upset her much more than Clary had realized.
"He's gone now, Jocelyn," said Luke. "I know it might seem half impossible. Valentine was always such a huge presence, even when he was in hiding. But he really is dead."
"My son isn't, though," said Jocelyn. "You know, I used to take this box out and cry over it every year on his birthday. I dream sometimes of a boy with big green eyes, a boy who was never poisoned with demon blood, a boy who could laugh and love and be human, and that is the boy I wept over, but that boy never existed."
"Take it out and cry over it," Clary thought. She knew what box her mother meant. A box that was a memorial to a child that had died, though he still lived. The box had contained locks of his baby hair, photographs, and a tiny shoe. The last time Clary had seen it, it had been in her brother's possession. Valentine must have given it to him, though she could never understand why Sebastian had kept it. He was hardly the sentimental sort.
"You're going to have to tell the Clave," Luke said. "If it's something that has to do with Sebastian, they'll want to know."
Clary felt her stomach go cold.
"I wish I didn't have to," Jocelyn said. "I wish I could throw the whole thing in the fire. I hate that this is my fault," she burst out. "And all I've ever wanted was to protect Clary, but the thing that frightens me most for her, for all of us, is someone who wouldn't even be alive if it weren't for me." Jocelyn's voice had gone flat and bitter.
"I should have killed him when he was a baby," she said, and leaned back, away from Luke so that Clary saw what was on the surface of the kitchen table. It was the silver box, just as she remembered it. Heavy, with a simple lid, and the initials JC carved into the side. The morning sun sparkled off the new gates in front of the guard. The old ones, Clary guessed, had been destroyed in the battle that had wrecked much of the guard and scorched the trees along the hillside. Past the gate, she could see Alicante below, shimmering water in the canals, the demon towers reaching up to where sunlight made them glitter like mica sparkling in stone. The guard itself had been restored. Fire had not destroyed the stone walls or towers. A wall still ran around it, and the new gates were made of the hard, clear adamas that formed the demon towers. They seemed to have been hand-wrought, their lines curving in to circle around the symbol of the council. Four C's in a square, standing for Council, Covenant, Clave, and Consul. The curvature of each C held a symbol of one of the branches of Downworlders. A crescent moon for the wolves, a spellbook for the warlocks, an elf arrow for the fair folk, and for the vampires, a star. A star. She hadn't been able to think of anything that symbolized vampires herself. Blood? Fangs? But there was something simple and elegant about the star. It was bright in the darkness, a darkness that would never be illuminated. And it was lonely, the way only things that could never die were lonely. Clary missed Simon with a sharp pain. She was exhausted after a night of little sleep and her emotional resources were low. It didn't help that she felt as if she were the center of 100 hostile stares. There were dozens of shadow hunters milling around the gates, most of them unfamiliar to her. Many were shooting Jocelyn and Luke covert glances. A few were coming up to greet them, while others stood back looking curious. Jocelyn seemed to be keeping her calm with a certain amount of effort. More shadow hunters were coming up the path along the guard hill. With relief, Clary recognized the Lightwoods. Maris in front, with Robert beside her, Isabel, Alec, and Jace following. They were wearing white mourning clothes. Maris looked especially somber. Clary couldn't help but notice that she and Robert were walking side by side but apart, not even their hands touching. Jace broke away from the group and moved over toward her. Gazes followed him as he went, though he seemed not to notice.
He was famous in a strange sort of way among the Nephilim. Valentine's son, who had not really been his son. Kidnapped by Sebastian, rescued by the Blade of Heaven. Clary knew the story well, as did everyone else close to Jace. But the rumors had grown like coral, adding layers and colors of story. Angel blood. Special powers. Heard that Valentine taught him tricks. Fire in his blood. Not right for Nephilim. She could hear the whispers, even as Jace moved among them. It was a bright winter day, cold but sunny, and the light picked the gold and silver threads out of his hair and made her squint as he came up to her at the gate. "Morning clothes," he said, touching the sleeve of her jacket. "You're wearing them," she pointed out. "I didn't think you had any." "Armatices," she said. "Listen, I have to tell you something." He let her draw him aside. Clary described the conversation she had overheard between her mother and Luke about the box. "It's definitely the box I remember. It's the one my mother had when I was growing up, and the one that was in Sebastian's apartment when I was there." Jace raked a hand through the light strands of his hair. "I thought there was something," he said. "Maris got a message from your mother this morning." His gaze was inward. "Sebastian turned Luke's sister," he added. "He did it on purpose to hurt Luke and hurt your mother through Luke. He hates her. He must have come to Alicante to get Armatice that night we fought at the Burren. He as much as told me he was going to do it, back when we were bound. He said he was going to kidnap a shadow hunter from Alicante, just not which one." Clary nodded. It was always strange to hear Jace talk about the self he had been, the Jace who had been Sebastian's friend, more than his friend, his ally. The Jace who had worn her Jace's skin and face, but had been someone else entirely. "He must have brought the box with him then, left it in her house," Jace added. "He would have known that your family would find it one day. He would have thought of it as a message or a signature." "Is that what the Clave thinks?" Clary asked. "It's what I think," Jace said, focusing on her. "And you know we both can read Sebastian better than they can or ever will. They don't understand him at all." "Aren't they lucky?" The sound of a bell echoed through the air and the gates slid open. Clary and Jace joined the Lightwoods, Luke, and Jocelyn in the tide of shadowhunters pouring through. They passed through the gardens outside the fortress, up a set of stairs, then through another set of doors into a long corridor that ended at the council chamber. Gia Penhallow, in consul robe, stood at the entrance to the chamber as shadowhunter after shadowhunter came through. It was built like an amphitheater, a half circle of tiered benches facing a rectangular raised dais in the front of the room. There were two lecterns on the dais, one for the consul and one for the inquisitor, and behind the lecterns, two windows, massive rectangles, looked out over Alicante. Clary moved to sit with the Lightwoods and her mother, while Robert Lightwood broke away from them and headed down the center aisle to take up the place of the inquisitor. On the dais, behind the lecterns, were four tall chairs, the back of each inscribed with a symbol: spellbook, moon, arrow, star. The seats for the downworlders of the council. Luke eyed his but seated himself next to Jocelyn. This was not a full council meeting with downworlder attendance. Luke wasn't here in an official capacity. In front of the seats a table had been erected, draped with blue velvet. Atop the velvet lay something long and sharp, something that glimmered in the light from the windows. The mortal sword. Clary glanced around. The flood of shadow hunters had slowed to a trickle. The room was nearly filled to its echoing roof. There had once been more entrances through the guard. Westminster Abbey had had one, she knew, as had the Sagrada Familia and St. Basil the Blessed, but they had been sealed when portals were invented. She couldn't help but wonder if some kind of magic kept the council room from overflowing. It was as full as she'd ever seen it, but there were still empty seats when Gia Penhallow stepped up onto the stage and clapped her hands sharply. "Will the council please come to attention?" she said. Silence fell quickly. Many of the shadow hunters were straining forward. Rumors had been flying around like panicked birds, and there was an electricity in the room, the crackling current of people desperate for information. "Bangkok, Buenos Aires, Oslo, Berlin, Moscow, Los Angeles," said Gia.
attacked in quick succession before the attacks could be reported. Before warnings could be given, every conclave in these cities has had its shadow hunters captured and turned. A few, pitifully few, the very old or very young, were simply killed, their bodies left for us to burn to add to the voices of lost shadow hunters in the silent city. A voice spoke from one of the front rows. A woman with black hair, the tattooed silver design of a koi fish, standing out on the dark skin of her cheek. Clary rarely saw shadow hunters with tattoos that weren't marks, but it wasn't unheard of. "You say turned," she said. "But do you not mean slain?" Gia's mouth tightened. "I do not mean slain," she said. "I mean turned. We speak of the Indarkan, the ones Jonathan Morgenstern, or as he prefers to be known, Sebastian, turn from their purpose as Nephilim using the Infernal Cup. Every institute was issued reports of what happened at the Baron. The existence of the Indarkan is something we have known of now for some time, even if there were perhaps those who did not want to believe it." A murmur went around the room. Clary barely heard it. She was aware that Jace's hand was around hers, but she was hearing the wind on the Baron and seeing shadow hunters rising from the Infernal Cup to face Sebastian, the marks of the Grey Book already fading from their skin.
"Shadow hunters don't fight shadow hunters," said an older man in one of the front rows. Jace murmured into his ear that he was the head of the Reykjavik Institute. "It is blasphemy."
"It is blasphemy," Gia agreed. "Blasphemy is Sebastian Morgenstern's creed. His father wanted to cleanse the world of downworlders. Sebastian wants something very different. He wants Nephilim reduced to ashes, and he wants to use Nephilim to do it."
"Surely if he was able to turn Nephilim into monsters, we ought to be able to find a way to turn them back," said Nazreen Chowdhury, the head of the Mumbai Institute, regal in her rune-decorated white sari. "Surely we should not give up so easily on our own."
"The body of one of the Indarkan was found at the Berlin site," said Robert. "He was injured, probably left for dead. The Silent Brothers are examining him right now to see if they can glean any information that might lead to a cure."
"Which Indarkand?" demanded the woman with the koi tattoo. "He had a name before he was turned, a shadow hunter name."
"Amalric Kriegsmesser," said Robert after a moment's hesitation. "His family has already been told."
"The warlocks of the Spiral Labyrinth are also working on a cure."
The whispered, omnidirectional voice of a Silent Brother echoed in the room. Clary recognized Brother Zachariah standing with his hands folded near the dais. Beside him was Helen Blackthorn, dressed in white mourning clothes, looking anxious.
"They're warlocks," said someone else in a dismissive tone. "Surely they won't do any better than our own Silent Brothers."
"Can't Kriegsmesser be interrogated?" interrupted a tall woman with white hair. "Perhaps he knows Sebastian's next move, or even a manner of curing his condition."
"Amalric Kriegsmesser is barely conscious, and besides, he is a servant of the Infernal Cup," said Brother Zachariah. "The Infernal Cup controls him completely. He has no will of his own, and therefore no will to break."
The woman with the koi tattoo spoke out again. "Is it true that Sebastian Morgenstern is invulnerable now, that he can't be killed?" There was a murmur in the room. Gia spoke, raising her voice. "As I said, there were no Nephilim survivors from the first of the attacks, but the last attack was on the Institute in Los Angeles, and six survived, six children." She turned. "Helen Blackthorn, if you please, bring the witnesses out." Clary saw Helen nod and disappear through a side door. A moment later, she returned. She was walking slowly now and carefully, a hand on the back of a thin boy with a mop of wavy brown hair. He couldn't have been older than 12. Clary recognized him immediately. She had seen him in the nave of the Institute the first time she had met Helen, his wrist clamped in his older sister's grip, his hands covered in wax where he had been playing with the tapers that decorated the interior of the cathedral. He had had an impish grin and the same blue-green eyes as his sister. Julian, Helen had called him, a little brother. The impish grin was gone now. He looked tired and dirty and frightened. Skinny wrists stuck out of the cuffs of a white morning jacket, the sleeves of which were too short for him. In his arms he was carrying a little boy, probably not more than 3 years old, with tangled brown curls. It seemed to be a family trait. The rest of the children wore similar borrowed morning clothes. Following Julian was a girl of about 10, her hand firmly clasped in the hold of a boy the same age. The girl's hair was dark brown, but the boy had tangled black curls that nearly obscured his face. Fraternal twins, Clary guessed. After them came a girl who might have been 8 or 9, her face round and very pale between brown braids. All of the Blackthorns, for the family resemblance was striking, looked bewildered and terrified, except perhaps Helen, whose expression was a mixture of fury and grief. The misery on their faces cut at Clary's heart. She thought of her power with runes, wishing that she could create one that would soften the blow of loss. Mourning runes existed, but only to honor the dead, in the same way that love runes existed, like wedding rings, to symbolize the bond of love. You couldn't make someone love you with a rune, and you couldn't assuage grief with it either. So much magic, Clary thought, and nothing to mend a broken heart. Julian Blackthorne, said Gia Penhallow, and her voice was gentle. Step forward, please. Julian swallowed and nodded, handing the little boy he was holding to his older sister. He stepped forward, his eyes darting around the dais. He was clearly scouring the space for someone. His shoulders had just begun to slump when another figure darted out onto the stage, a girl, also about 12, with a tangle of dark blonde hair that hung down around her shoulders. She wore jeans and a t-shirt that didn't quite fit, and her head was down, as if she couldn't bear so many people looking at her. It was clear that she didn't want to be there, on the stage or perhaps even in Idris, but the moment he saw her, Julian seemed to relax. The terrified look vanished from his expression as she moved to stand beside Helen, her face tucked down and away from the crowd. Julian, said Gia in the same gentle voice, would you do something for us? Would you take up the mortal sword? Clary sat up straight. She had held the mortal sword. She had felt the weight of it. The cold, like hooks in your skin, dragged the truth out of you. You couldn't lie holding the mortal sword, but the truth, even a truth you wanted to tell, was agony. They can't, she whispered. He's just a kid. He's the oldest of the children who escaped the Los Angeles Institute, Jay said under his breath. They don't have a choice. Julian nodded, his thin shoulders straight. I'll take it. Robert Lightwood passed behind the lectern then and went to the table. He took up the sword and returned to stand in front of Julian. The contrast between them was almost funny. The big, barrel-chested man and the lanky, wild-haired boy. Julian reached a hand up and took the sword. As his fingers closed around the hilt, he shuddered, a ripple of pain that was quickly forced down. The blonde girl behind him started forward, and Clary caught a glimpse of the look on her face, pure fury, before Helen caught at her and pulled her back. Gia knelt down. It was a strange sight, the boy with the sword bracketed on one side by the consul, her robe spreading out about her, and on the other by the inquisitor. Julian, Gia said, and though her voice was low, it carried throughout the council room. Can you tell us who is on the stage here with you today? In his clear boy's voice, Julian said, You, the Inquisitor, my family, my sister Helen, and Tiberius, and Livia, and Drusilla, and Tavi, Octavian, and my best friend, Emma Carstairs. And they were all with you when the Institute was attacked? Julian shook his head. Not Helen, he said. She was here. Can you tell us what you saw, Julian, without leaving anything out? Julian swallowed. He was pale. Clary could imagine the pain he was feeling, the weight of the sword. It was in the afternoon, he said. We were practicing in the training room. Katerina was teaching us, Mark was watching. Emma's parents were on a routine patrol at the beach. We saw a flash of light. I thought it was lightning or fireworks, but it wasn't. Katerina and Mark left us and went downstairs. They told us to stay in the training room. But you didn't, Gia said. We could hear the sounds of fighting. We split up. Emma went to get Drusilla and Octavian, and I went to the office with Livia and Tiberius to call the Clave. We had to sneak by the main entrance to get there. When we did, I saw him. Him?
I knew he was a shadow hunter, but not. He was wearing a red cloak covered in runes.
What runes?
I didn't know them, but there was something wrong with them. Not like the gray book runes. They gave me a sort of sick feeling to look at. And he pushed his hood back. He had white hair, so I thought he was old at first. Then I realized it was Sebastian Morgenstern. He was holding a sword.
Can you describe the sword?
Silver, with a pattern of black stars on the blade and the handle. He took it out and he... Julian's breath skittered and Clary could almost feel it. Feel his horror at the recollection, warring with the compulsion to tell it, to relive it. She was leaning forward, her hands in fists, hardly aware that her nails were digging into her palms. He held it to my father's throat, Julian went on. There were others with Sebastian. They were wearing red, too.
Shadow hunters? Gia said.
I don't know. Julian's breath was coming short. Some wore black cloaks, others wore gear, but their gear was red. I've never seen red gear. There was a woman with brown hair, and she was holding a cup that looked like the mortal cup. She made my father drink out of it. He fell down and screamed. I could hear my brother screaming, too.
Which brother? Asked Robert Lightwood.
Mark, said Julian. I saw them start to move into the entryway, and Mark turned around and shouted for us to run upstairs and get out. I fell on the top step, and when I looked down, they were swarming all over him. Julian made a gagging sound. My father, he was standing up, and his eyes were black, too, and he started moving toward Mark like the rest of them, like he didn't even know him. Julian's voice cracked, just as the blonde girl wrenched herself free of Helen's grasp and hurtled forward, throwing herself between Julian and the consul. Emma, Helen said, stepping forward, but Gia held out a hand to keep her back. Emma was white-faced and gasping. Clary thought that she had never seen so much anger contained in such a small form. Leave him alone, Emma shouted, throwing her arms out wide as if she could shield Julian behind her, though she was a head shorter. You're torturing him! Leave him alone!
It's okay, Emma, Julian said, though the color was starting to come back into his face now that they were no longer questioning him.
They have to do it.
She turned on him.
No, they don't! I was there too! I saw what happened! Do it to me!
She held out her hands, as if begging for the sword to be put into them.
I'm the one who stabbed Sebastian in the heart. I'm the one who saw him not die. You should be asking me.
No, Julian began, and then Gia said, still gently, Emma, we will question you next. The sword is painful, but not harmful.
Stop it, Emma said. Just stop it.
And she walked over to Julian, who was holding the sword tightly. It was clear he had no intention of trying to hand it over. He was shaking his head at Emma, even as she laid her hands over his so that both of them were holding the sword together.
I stabbed Sebastian, Emma said in a voice that rang out through the room. And he pulled the dagger out and laughed. He said, it's a shame you won't live. Live to tell the clave that Lilith has strengthened me beyond all measure. Perhaps glorious could end my life. A pity for the Nephilim, that they have no more favors they can ask of heaven, and none of the puny instruments of war they forge in their adamant citadel can harm me now.
Clary shuddered. She heard Sebastian through Emma's words and could almost see him standing in front of her. Chatter had burst out among the clave, drowning what Jace said to her next.
Are you sure you didn't miss the heart? Robert demanded, his dark eyebrows drawn together.
It was Julian who answered.
Emma doesn't miss, he said, sounding as offended as if they had just insulted him. I know where the heart is, Emma said, stepping back from Julian and casting a look of anger, more than anger, hurt, at the consul and the Inquisitor. But I don't think you do.
Her voice rose and she spun and ran off the dais, practically elbowing her way past Robert. She disappeared through the door from which she had come, and Clary heard her own breath rush out through her teeth. Wasn't anyone going to go after her? Julian clearly wanted to, but, trapped between the consul and the Inquisitor, carrying the weight of the mortal sword, he couldn't move. Helen was looking after her with an expression of raw pain, her arms cradling the youngest boy, Tavi. And then Clary was on her feet. Her mother reached for her, but she was already running down the sloping aisle between the rows of seats. The aisle turned into wooden steps. Clary clattered up them, past the consul and inquisitor, past Helen and through the side door after Emma. She nearly knocked over Aline, who was hovering near the open door, watching what was going on in the council room and scowling. The scowl disappeared when she saw Clary and was replaced by a look of surprise.
"What are you doing?"
"The little girl," Clary said breathlessly. "Emma, she ran back here."
"I know. I tried to stop her, but she pulled away from me. She's just..."
Aline sighed and glanced at the council room where Gia had begun to question Julian again. "It's been so hard on them, Helen and the others. You know their mother died only a few years ago. All they've got now is an uncle in London."
"Does that mean they're gonna move the kids to London? You know when this is all over?" Clary said.
Aline shook her head. "Their uncle's been offered the leadership of the Los Angeles Institute. I think the hope is that he'll take over the job and raise the kids. I don't think he's agreed yet, though. He's probably in shock. I mean, he lost his nephew, his brother. Andrew Blackthorne isn't dead, but he might as well be. In a way, it's worse." Her voice was bitter.
"I know," Clary said. "I know exactly what that's like."
Aline looked at her more closely.
"I suppose you do," she said.
"It's just, Helen, I wish I could do more for her. She's eating herself up with guilt because she was here with me and not in Los Angeles when the Institute was attacked. And she's trying so hard, but she can't be a mom to all those kids, and their uncle hasn't gotten here yet, and there's Emma, Angel, help her. She doesn't even have a scrap of family left."
"I'd like to talk to her, to Emma."
Aline tucked a lock of hair behind her ear, the Blackthorn ring shimmering on her right hand.
"She won't talk to anyone but Julian."
"Let me try," Clary urged.
"Please."
Aline looked at the determined expression on Clary's face and sighed. Down the hall, the first room on the left. The hall curved away from the council room. Clary could hear the voices of the shadow hunters fading as she walked. The walls were smooth stone, lined with tapestries that depicted various glorious scenes from Shadowhunter history. The first door that appeared on her left was wooden, very plain. It was partly ajar, but she rapped quickly before opening it, so as not to surprise whoever was inside. It was a simple room, with wooden wainscoting and a jumble of chairs hastily assembled. It felt to Clary like a hospital waiting room. It had that heavy sense in the air, of an impermanent place where people spent their anxiety and grief in unfamiliar surroundings. In the corner of the room was a chair propped against a wall, and in the chair was Emma. She looked smaller than she had from a distance. She was only wearing a short-sleeved t-shirt, and on her bare arms were marks, the Voyant's rune on her left hand, so she was left-handed like Jace, which lay on the hilt of an unsheathed short sword lying across her lap. Up close, Clary could see that her hair was a pale blonde, but tangled and dirty enough that it had looked darker. From between the tangles, the girl glared up at Clary defiantly.
"What?" she said. "What do you want?"
"Nothing," Clary said, pushing the door shut behind her. "Just to talk to you." Emma's eyes narrowed in suspicion.
"You want to use the mortal sword on me? Interrogate me?"
"No, I've had it used on me and it's awful. I'm sorry they're using it on your friend. I think they should find another way."
"I think they should trust him," said Emma. "Julian doesn't lie."
She looked at Clary challengingly, as if daring her to disagree.
"Of course he doesn't,"
Clary said and took a step into the room. She felt as if she were trying not to frighten off some kind of wild creature in the forest.
"Julian's your best friend, isn't he?"
Emma nodded.
"My best friend is a boy, too. His name is Simon."
"So where is he?" Emma's eyes flicked behind Clary as if she expected Simon to materialize suddenly.
"He's in New York," said Clary. "I miss him a lot."
Emma looked as if this made enormous sense.
"Julian went to New York once," she said. "I missed him, so when he got back, I made him promise he wouldn't go anywhere without me again."
Clary smiled and moved closer to Emma.
"Your sword is beautiful," she said, pointing at the blade across the girl's lap.
Emma's expression softened fractionally. She touched the blade, which was etched with a delicate pattern of leaves and runes. The crossbar was gold, and across the blade were carved words. "I am Cortana, of the same steel and temper as Joyeuse and Durandal." "It was my father's.
It's been passed down through the Carstairs family. It's a famous sword, she added proudly. It was made a long time ago. Of the same steel and temper as Joyeuse and Durendal, said Clary. Those are both famous swords. You know who owns famous swords?
Who?
Heroes, Clary said, kneeling down on the ground so she could look up into the girl's face. Emma scowled.
I'm not a hero, she said. I didn't do anything to save Julian's father or Mark.
I'm so sorry, said Clary. I know how it is to watch someone you care about go dark, get turned into someone else. But Emma was shaking her head.
Mark didn't go dark. He got taken away.
Clary frowned.
Taken away?
They didn't want him to drink from the cup because of his fairy blood, said Emma, and Clary recalled Alex saying that there was a fairy ancestor in the Blackthorn family tree. As if anticipating Clary's next question, Emma said wearily,
Only Mark and Helen have fairy blood. They had the same mother, but she left them with Mr. Blackthorn when they were small. Julian and the others had a different mom.
Oh, Clary said, not wanting to press too hard, not wanting this damaged girl to think that she was just another adult who saw Emma as a source of answers for her questions and nothing else.
I know Helen.
Does Mark look like her?
Yeah, Helen and Mark have pointy ears a little, and light hair. None of the rest of the Blackthorns are blonde. They all have brown hair except Ty, and no one knows why he has black hair. Livy doesn't have it, and she's his twin.
A little color and animation had come back into Emma's face. It was clear she liked to talk about the Blackthorns.
So they didn't want Mark to drink from the cup, said Clary.
Privately, she was surprised that Sebastian would care one way or the other. He'd never had Valentine's obsession with Downworlders, though it wasn't as if he liked them.
Maybe it doesn't work if you have Downworlder blood.
Maybe, said Emma. Clary reached out and put her hand over one of Emma's. She dreaded the answer, but couldn't keep herself from asking the question.
He didn't turn your parents, did he?
No, no, Emma said, and now her voice was shaking. They're dead. They weren't at the Institute. They were investigating a report of demon activity. Their bodies washed up on the beach after the attack. I could have gone with them, but I wanted to stay back at the Institute. I wanted to train with Jules. If I'd just gone with them...
If you had, you'd be dead too, said Clary.
How would you know? Emma demanded, but there was something in her eyes, something that wanted to believe it.
I can see what a good shadow hunter you are, Clary said. I see your marks, I see your scars, and how you hold your sword. If you're that good, I can only imagine they were really good too. And something that could have killed them both isn't something you could have saved them from.
She touched the sword lightly.
Heroes aren't always the ones who win, she said. They're the ones who lose sometimes, but they keep fighting, they keep coming back, they don't give up. That's what makes them heroes.
Emma drew in a shaky breath, just as a rapping noise sounded at the door. Clary half turned as it opened, letting in light from the hall outside, and Jace. He caught her eye and smiled, leaning in the doorway. His hair was very dark gold, his eyes a shade lighter. Clary sometimes thought she could see the fire inside him, lighting his eyes and skin and veins moving just under the surface.
Clary, he said.
Clary thought she heard a small squeak from behind her. Emma was clutching her sword, looking between Clary and Jace with very large eyes.
The council's over, he said, and I don't think Gia's any too pleased you came running back here.
So I'm in trouble, Clary said.
As usual. Jace said, but his smile took any sting out of it. We're all leaving. Are you ready to go?
She shook her head.
I'll meet you at your house. You guys can fill me in on what happened at the council then.
He hesitated.
Get Aline or Helen to come with you, he said finally. The consul's house is just down the street from the Inquisitor's.
He zipped his jacket up and slipped out of the room, closing the door behind him. Clary turned back to Emma, who was still staring at her.
You know Jace Lightwood? Said Emma.
What?
He's famous, Emma said with obvious amazement. He's the best shadow hunter, the best.
He's my friend, Clary said, noting that the conversation had taken an unexpected turn. Emma gave her a superior look.
He's your boyfriend.
How did you...
I saw the way he looked at you, said Emma.
And anyway, everyone knows that Jace Lightwood has a girlfriend and she's Clary Fairchild. Why didn't you tell me your name?
I guess I didn't think you'd know it, Clary said, reeling.
I'm not stupid, Emma said with an air of annoyance that had Clary straightening up quickly before she could laugh.
No, you're not. You're really smart, said Clary.
And I'm glad you know who I am, because I want you to know you can come talk to me anytime. Not just about what happened to the Institute, about whatever you want, and you can talk to Jace, too. Do you need to know where to find us?
Emma shook her head.
No, she said, her voice soft again. I know where the Inquisitor's house is.
Okay. Clary folded her hands, mostly to keep herself from reaching out and hugging the girl. She didn't think Emma would appreciate it.
Clary turned towards the door. If you're Jace Lightwood's girlfriend, you should have a better sword, Emma said suddenly, and Clary glanced down at the blade she'd strapped on that morning, an old one she'd packed with her belongings from New York.
She touched the hilt. This one isn't good?
Emma shook her head.
Not good at all.
She sounded so serious that Clary smiled.
Thanks for the advice.
4. Darker than gold. When Clary knocked on the door of the Inquisitor's house, it was opened by Robert Lightwood. For a moment she froze, unsure what to say. She had never had a conversation with Jace's adoptive father, had never known him well at all. He had been a shadow in the background, usually behind Maris, with his hand on her chair. He was a big, dark-haired man with a neatly trimmed beard. She could not imagine him being friends with her own father, though she knew he had been in Valentine's circle. There were too many lines on his face, and there was too hard a set to his jaw for her to imagine him young. When he looked at her, she saw that his eyes were a very dark blue, so dark she had always thought they were black. His expression didn't change. She could feel disapproval radiating off him. She suspected Gia wasn't the only one annoyed that she'd run out of the council meeting after Emma.
If you're looking for my children, they're upstairs, was all he said. Top floor.
She passed by him, into the extremely grand front room. The house, the one officially designated to the Inquisitor and his or her family, was grand in its scope, with high ceilings and heavy, expensive-looking furniture. It was a large enough space to have interior archways, a massive grand staircase, and a chandelier that hung down from the ceiling, glowing with dim witch light. She wondered where Maris was, and if she liked the house.
Thanks, Clary said.
Robert Lightwood shrugged and disappeared into the shadows without another word. Clary took the stairs two at a time, passing several landings before she reached the top floor, which was up a flight of steep attic stairs that led to a corridor. A door down the hall was half open. She could hear voices from the other side. With a perfunctory knock, she stepped inside. The walls of the attic room were painted white, and there was a massive armoire in the corner, both doors flung open. Alec's clothes, practical and a little shabby, hanging on one side, and Jace's crisp in blacks and greys on the other. Their gear was neatly folded along the bottom. Clary almost smiled. She wasn't entirely sure why. There was something about Alec and Jace's sharing a room that she found endearing. She wondered if they kept each other up at night talking, the way she and Simon always had. Alec and Isabel were perched on the sill of the window. Behind them, Clary could see the colors of the sunset sparking off the water of the canal below. Jace was sprawled on one of the single beds, his boots rather defiantly planted on the velvet coverlet. I think they mean they can't just wait around for Sebastian to attack more institutes, Alec was saying. That would be hiding. Shadowhunters don't hide. Jace rubbed his cheek against his shoulder. He looked tired, his pale hair rumpled.
Feels like hiding, he said. Sebastian's out there. We're in here, double warded, all the institutes emptied out, no one to protect the world from demons. Who will watch the watchers?
Alec sighed and rubbed a hand over his face. Hopefully it won't be for long. Hard to imagine what would happen, Isabel said. A world with no shadow hunters, demons everywhere, downworlders attacking one another.
If I were Sebastian, Jace started.
But you're not Sebastian, Clary said.
They all looked over at her. Alec and Jace looked absolutely nothing alike, Clary thought, but every once in a while there was a similarity in the way that they glanced or gestured that reminded her that they'd been raised together. They both looked curious, a little concerned. Isabel seemed more tired and upset. "You all right?" Jace said by way of greeting, giving her a lopsided smile. "How's Emma?"
"Wrecked," Clary said.
"What happened after I left the meeting?"
"The interrogation was mostly over," said Jace. "Sebastian's obviously behind the attacks, and he has a sizable force of Andarkan warriors backing him up. Nobody knows exactly how many, but we have to assume that all of the missing have been turned."
"Still, we have greater numbers by far," said Alec. "He has his original forces, and the 6 conclaves he turned, we have everyone else." There was something in Jace's eyes that turned them darker than gold.
"Sebastian knows that," he murmured. "He'll know his forces down to the last warrior. He'll know exactly what he can match and what he can't."
"We have the Downworlders on our side," said Alec. "That's the whole point of tomorrow's meeting, isn't it? Talk to the representatives, strengthen our alliances. Now we know what Sebastian's doing, we can strategize around it. Hit him with the Knight's children, the courts, the warlocks."
Clary's eyes met Jace's in silent communication. "Now that we know what Sebastian's doing, he'll do something else, something we don't expect yet."
"And then everyone talked about Jace," said Isabel. "So, you know, the usual."
"About Jace?" Clary leaned against the footboard of Jace's bed. "What about him?"
"There was a lot of back and forth about whether Sebastian's basically invulnerable now, and if there are ways to wound and kill him. Glorious could have done it because of the heavenly fire, but currently, the only source of heavenly fire is...
Jace," Clary said grimly.
"But the Silent Brothers have tried everything to separate Jace from the heavenly fire, and they can't do it. It's in his soul. So what's their plan, hitting Sebastian over the head with Jace until he passes out?"
"Brother Zachariah said pretty much the same thing," Jace said, maybe with less sarcasm.
"Anyway, they wound up talking about ways to capture Sebastian without killing him. They can destroy all the Andarkand if he can be trapped somewhere or somehow. It might not matter as much if he can't be killed," Alec said.
"Put him in an Adamus coffin and drop it into the sea," Isabel said. "That's my suggestion."
"Anyway, when they were done talking about me, which was of course the best part," Jace said, "they went back pretty quickly to talking about ways to cure the Andarkand. They're paying the Spiral Labyrinth a fortune to try to unravel the spell Sebastian used to create the Infernal Cup and enact the ritual.
They need to stop obsessing about curing the Andarkand and start thinking about how to defeat them," Isabel said in a hard voice.
"A lot of them know people who returned, Isabel," said Alec. "Of course they want them back."
"Well, I want my little brother back," said Isabel, her voice rising. "Don't they understand what Sebastian did? He killed them. He killed what was human about them, and he left demons walking around in skin suits that looked like people we used to know. That's all."
"Keep it down," Alec said in his determined older brother tone. "You know Mum and Dad are in the house, right? They'll come up."
"Oh, they're here," said Isabel, "about as far away from each other bedroom-wise as you can possibly be, but they're here."
"It's not our business where they sleep, Isabel."
"They're our parents."
"But they have their own lives," said Alec, "and we have to respect that and stay out of it." His expression darkened. "A lot of people split up when they have a child who dies."
Isabel gave a little gasp.
"Is he?" Alec seemed to realize he had gone too far. Mentions of Max seemed to devastate Isabel more than they did any of the other Lightwoods, even Maris. Isabel turned and ran out of the room, slamming the door behind her. Alec shoved his fingers into his hair, causing it to stick up like duck fluff. "God damn it," he swore, and then flushed. Alec hardly ever swore, and usually when he did, he muttered. He shot Jace an almost apologetic look and went after his sister. Jace sighed, swung his long legs off the bed, and stood up. He stretched like a cat, cracking his shoulders.
"Guess that's my cue to walk you home.
I can find my way back." He shook his head, grabbing his jacket off the bedpost. There was something impatient about his movement, something prowling and watchful that made Clary's own skin prickle. "I want to get out of here anyway. Come on, let's go."
"It's been an hour. At least an hour, I swear," Maya said. She was lying on the couch in Jordan and Simon's apartment, her bare feet in Jordan's lap. "Shouldn't have ordered Ty," Simon said absently. He was sitting on the floor, fiddling with the Xbox controller. It hadn't been working for several days. There was a Duraflame log in the fireplace. Like everything else in the apartment, the fireplace was poorly maintained, and half the time the room would fill with smoke when they used it. Jordan was always complaining of the cold, the cracks in the windows and walls, and the landlord's disinterest in fixing anything. They never come on time. Jordan grinned good-naturedly. What do you care? You don't eat. I can drink now, Simon pointed out. It was true. He'd trained his stomach to accept most liquids. Milk, coffee, tea. Those solid foods still made him rich. He doubted the drinks did anything much for him in the way of nutrition. Only blood seemed to do that. But it made him feel more human to be able to consume something in public that wouldn't send everyone screaming. With a sigh, he dropped the controller. I think this thing is broken. Permanently. Which is great, because I have no money to replace it. Jordan looked at him curiously. Simon had brought all his savings from home when he'd moved in, but that hadn't been much. Fortunately, he also had few expenses. The apartment was on loan from the Praetor Lupus, who also provided Simon's blood. I've got money, Jordan said. We'll be fine. That's your money, not mine. You're not going to be watching me forever, Simon said, staring into the blue flames of the fireplace. And then what? I'd be applying for college soon if everything hadn't happened. Music school. I could learn, get a job. No one's going to employ me now. I look 16. I always will. Maya said. I guess vampires don't really have jobs, do they? I mean, some werewolves do. Bat's a DJ, and Luke owns that bookstore. But vampires are all in clans. There aren't really vampire scientists. Or vampire musicians, said Simon. Let's face it, my career is now professional vampire. I'm actually kind of surprised the vampires haven't been rampaging through the streets, eating tourists, what with Maureen leading them, said Maya. She's pretty bloodthirsty. Simon made a face. I assume some of the clan are trying to control her. Raphael, probably. Lily, she's one of the smartest of the vampire clan. Knows everything. She and Raphael were always thick as thieves. But I don't exactly have vampire friends. Considering what a target I am, sometimes I'm surprised I have any friends. He heard the bitterness in his own voice and glanced across the room at the pictures Jordan had tacked up on the wall. Pictures of himself with his friends, at the beach, with Maya. Simon had thought of putting up his own photos. Though he hadn't taken any from his house, Clary had some. He could have borrowed them, made the apartment more his own. But though he liked living with Jordan and felt comfortable there, it wasn't home. It didn't feel permanent, as if he could make a life there. I don't even have a bed, he said out loud. Maya turned her head toward him. Simon, what is this about? Is it because Isabel left? Simon shrugged. I don't know. I mean, yes, I miss Izzy, but Clary says the two of us need to DTR. Oh, define the relationship, Maya said at Jordan's puzzled look. You know, when you decide if you're actually girlfriend and boyfriend, which you should do, by the way. Why does everyone know this acronym but me? Simon wondered aloud. Does Isabel want to be my girlfriend? Can't tell you, said Maya. Girl code. Ask her. She's an Idris. Ask her when she gets back. Simon was silent, and Maya added more gently, She'll come back. And Clary, too. It's just a meeting. I don't know. The institutes aren't safe. Neither are you, said Jordan. That's why you have me. Maya looked at Jordan. There was something odd in the look, something Simon couldn't quite identify. There had been something off between Maya and Jordan for some time now, a distance from Maya, a question in her eyes when she looked at her boyfriend. Simon had been waiting for Jordan to say something to him, but Jordan hadn't. Simon wondered if Jordan had noticed Maya's distance. It was obvious. Or if he was stubbornly in denial. Would you still be a daylighter? Maya asked, turning her attention to Simon. If you could change it? I don't know. Simon had asked himself the same question, then pushed it away. There was no point obsessing over things you couldn't change. Being a daylighter meant that you had gold in your veins. other vampires wanted it, for if they drank your blood, they too could walk in the sun. But just as many wanted you destroyed, for it was the belief of most vampires that daylighters were an abomination to be rooted out. He remembered Raphael's words to him on the roof of a Manhattan hotel. You had better pray, daylighter, that you do not lose that mark before the war comes, for if you do, there will be a line of enemies waiting their turn to kill you, and I will be at the head of it. And yet, I would miss the sun, he said. It keeps me human, I think. The light from the fire sparked off Jordan's eyes as he looked at Simon. Being human's overrated, he said with a smile. Maya swung her feet off his legs abruptly. Jordan looked over at her, worried, just as the doorbell rang. Simon was on his feet in a flash. Take out, he announced. I'll go get it. Besides, he added over his shoulder as he headed down the hall to the front door, no one's tried to kill me in 2 weeks. Maybe they got bored and gave up. He heard the murmur of voices behind him, but didn't listen. They were talking to each other. He reached for the knob and swung the door open, already fumbling for his wallet. And there was a throb against his chest. He glanced down to see Isabel's pendant flash bright scarlet and threw himself backward, just missing a hand thrust out to grab him. He yelled out loud. There was a looming figure dressed in red gear in the doorway, a Shadowhunter man with ugly splashes of runes on both cheeks, a hawk-like nose, and a broad, pale forehead. He snarled at Simon and advanced. Simon, get down! Jordan shouted. And Simon threw himself flat and rolled to the side just as a crossbow bolt exploded along the hallway. The dark Shadowhunter spun sideways with almost unbelievable speed. The bolt embedded itself in the door. Simon heard Jordan curse in frustration, and then Maya, in wolf form, sprang past him, leaping at the Indarkened. There was a satisfying howl of pain as her teeth sank into his throat. Blood sprayed out, filling the air with a salty red mist. Simon inhaled it, tasting the bitter tang of demon-tainted blood as he rose to his feet. He stepped forward just as the Indarkened seized hold of Maya and threw her down the hall, a thrashing, howling ball of teeth and claws. Jordan shouted. Simon was making a noise low in his own throat, a sort of vampire hiss, and he could feel his fanged teeth snap out. The Indarkened stepped forward, pouring blood, but still steady. Simon felt a pang of fear low in his gut. He had seen them fight at the Burren, Sebastian's soldiers, and he knew that they were stronger, faster, and harder to kill than Shadowhunters. He hadn't really thought about how much harder to kill they were than vampires. Get out of the way! Jordan grabbed Simon by the shoulders and half threw him after Maya, who had scrambled to her feet. There was blood on her ruff, and her wolf eyes were dark with rage. Get out, Simon. Let us deal with this. Get out! Simon stood his ground. I'm not going. He's here for me. I know that, Jordan shouted. I'm your Praetor Lupus guard. Now let me do my job. Jordan swung around, bringing up his crossbow again. This time, the bolt sank into the dark Shadowhunter's shoulder. He staggered back and let loose a string of curses in a language Simon didn't know. German, he thought. The Berlin Institute had been hit. Maya sprang past Simon, and she and Jordan closed in on the dark Shadowhunter. Jordan glanced back once at Simon, his hazel eyes fierce and wild. Simon nodded and darted back into the living room. He slammed open the window. It gave with a fierce shriek of swollen wood and an explosion of old paint chips, and climbed out onto the fire escape, where Jordan's wolfsbane plants, withered by winter air, crowded the metal ledge. Every part of him screamed that he shouldn't be leaving, but he had promised Isabel. Promised he would let Jordan do his work as bodyguard. Promised he wouldn't make himself a target. He clasped one hand around Izzy's pendant, warm under his fingers as if it had lain recently against her throat, and headed down the metal steps. They were clanging and slippery with snow. He almost fell several times before he reached the last rung and dropped to the shadowy pavement below, and was immediately surrounded by vampires. Simon had time to recognize only two of them as part of the Hotel du Mort clan. Delicate dark-haired Lily and blonde Zeke, both grinning like fiends, before something was thrown over his head. Fabric pulled tight around his throat, and he choked. Not because he needed air, but because of the pain of having his throat compressed. "Maureen sends her regards," said Zeke into his ear. Simon opened his mouth to scream, but darkness claimed him before he could make a sound.
"I didn't realize you were quite so famous," said Clary as she and Jace made their way down the narrow pavement that ran alongside Old Way Canal. It was turning to evening. Darkness had only just fallen, and the streets were full of people hurrying to and fro, wrapped in thick cloaks, their faces cold and closed off. Stars were beginning to come out, a soft prickle of light across the eastern sky. They illuminated Jace's eyes as he looked over at Clary curiously.
"Everyone knows Valentine's son."
"I know, but when Emma saw you, she acted like you were her celebrity crush. Like you were on the cover of Shadowhunters Weekly every month. You know, when they asked me to pose, they said it would be tasteful. As long as you were holding a strategically placed Seraph blade, I don't see the problem," Clary said, and Jace laughed, a cut-off sound that indicated that she had surprised the amusement out of him. It was her favorite laugh of his. Jace was always so controlled. It was still a delight to be one of the few people who could get under his carefully constructed armor and surprise him. "You liked her, didn't you?" Jace said. "Throne," Clary said. "Liked who?" They were passing through a square, she recalled, cobblestoned with a well in the center, covered now with a stone circle, probably to keep the water from freezing. "That girl, Emma." "There was something about her," Clary acknowledged. "The way she stood up for Helen's brother, maybe. Julian, she'd do anything for him. She really loves the Blackthorns, and she's lost everyone else." "She reminded you of you."
"I don't think so," Clary said. "I think maybe she reminded me of you. Because I'm tiny blonde and look good in pigtails?"
Clary bumped him with her shoulder. They had reached the top of a street lined with stores. The stores were closed now, though witchlight glowed through the barred windows. Clary had the sense of being in a dream or fairy tale, a sense that Alicante never failed to give her. The vast sky overhead, the ancient buildings carved with scenes out of legends, and over everything, the clear demon towers that gave Alicante its common name, the City of Glass. "Because she lost her blood family," she said as they passed a store with loaves of bread stacked in the window. "But she has the Blackthorns. She doesn't have anyone else. No aunts or uncles, no one to take her in, but the Blackthorns will. So she'll have to learn what you did. That family isn't blood, it's the people who love you. The people who have your back like the Lightwoods did for you." Jace had stopped walking. Clary turned around to look at him. The crowd of pedestrians parted around them. He was standing in front of the entrance to a narrow alley by a shop. The wind that blew up the street ruffled his blonde hair and his unzipped jacket. She could see the pulse in his throat. "Come here," he said, and his voice was rough. Clary took a step toward him, a little warily. Had she said something that had upset him? Though Jace was rarely angry at her, and when he was straightforward about it. He reached out, took her hand gently, and led her after him as he ducked around the corner of the building and into the shadows of a narrow passage that wound towards a canal in the distance. There was no one else in the passageway with them, and its narrow entrance blocked the view from the street. Jace's face was all angles in the dimness, sharp cheekbones, soft mouth, the golden eyes of a lion. "I love you," he said. "I don't say it often enough, I love you." She leaned back against the wall. The stone was cold. Under other circumstances, it might have been uncomfortable, but she didn't care at that moment. She pulled him toward her carefully until their bodies were lined up, not quite touching, but so close that she could feel the heat radiating off him. Of course he didn't need to zip his jacket, not with the fire burning through his veins. The scent of black pepper and soap and cold air clung around him as she pressed her face into his shoulder and breathed him in. "Clary," he said. His voice was a whisper and a warning. She could hear the roughness of longing in it, longing for the physical reassurance of closeness, of any touch at all. Carefully, he reached around her to place the palms of his hands against the stone wall, caging her into the space made by his arms. She felt his breath in her hair, the light brush of his body against hers. Every inch of her seemed supersensitized. Everywhere he touched, she felt as if tiny needles of pleasure pain were being dragged across her skin.
Please don't tell me you pull me into an alley and you're touching me and you don't plan on kissing me, because I don't think I could take it, she said in a low voice. He closed his eyes. She could see his dark lashes feathering against his cheeks, remembered the feel of mapping the shape of his face under her fingers, of the full weight of his body on hers, the way his skin felt against her skin. I don't, he said, and she could hear the dark roughness under the usual smooth glide of his voice. Honey over needles. They were close enough together that when he breathed in, she could feel the expansion of his chest. We can't. She put her hand against his chest. His heart was beating like trapped wings. Take me home, then, she whispered, and she leaned up to brush her lips against the corner of his mouth. Or at least she meant it as a brush, a butterfly touch of lips on lips. But he leaned down toward her, and his movement changed the angle swiftly. She pressed up against him harder than she'd meant to, her lips sliding to center against his. She felt him breathe out in surprise against her mouth, and then they were kissing, really kissing, exquisitely slow and hot and intense. Take me home. But this was home, Jace's arms surrounding her, the cold wind of Alicante in their clothes, her fingers digging into the back of his neck, the place where his hair curled softly against his skin. His palms were still flat against the stone behind her, but he moved his body against hers, gently pressing her up against the wall. She could hear the harsh undertone of his breathing. He wouldn't touch her with his hands, but she could touch him. She let her hands go freely, over the swell of his arms, down to his chest, tracing the ridges of muscles, pressing outward to grip his sides until his t-shirt was rucking up under her fingers. Her fingertips touched bare skin, and then she was sliding her hands up under his shirt. And she hadn't touched him like this in so long, had nearly forgotten how his skin was soft where it wasn't scarred, how the muscles in his back jumped under her touch. He gasped into her mouth. He tasted like tea and chocolate and salt. She had taken control of the kiss. Now she felt him tense as he took it back, biting her lower lip until she shuddered, nipping at the corner of her mouth, kissing along her jawbone to suck at the pulse point at her throat, swallowing her racing heartbeat. His skin burned under her hands, burned. He broke away, reeling back almost drunkenly, hitting the opposite wall. His eyes were wide, and for a dizzy moment, Clary thought she could see flames in them, like twin fires in the darkness. Then the light went out of them, and he was only gasping as if he had been running, pressing the heels of his palms against his face. Jace, she said. He dropped his hands. Look at the wall behind you, he said in a flat voice. She turned and stared. Behind her, where he had been leaning, were twin scorch marks in the stone, in the exact shape of his hands.
The Sealy Queen lay upon her bed and looked up at the stone ceiling of her bedchamber. It was wreathed with dangling trellises of roses, thorns still intact, each one perfect and blood red. Every night they withered and died, and every morning they were replaced, as fresh as the day before. Fairy slept little and rarely dreamed, but the queen liked her bed to be comfortable. It was a wide couch of stone, with a feather mattress laid on top, and covered with thick swaths of velvet and slippery satin. "Have you ever," said the boy in the bed beside her, "pricked yourself on one of the thorns, Your Majesty?" She turned to look at Jonathan Morgenstern, sprawled among the covers. Though he had asked her to call him Sebastian, which she respected, no fairy would allow another to address them by their true name either. He was on his stomach, head pillowed on his crossed arms, and even in the dim light, the old whip wheels across his back were visible. The queen had always been fascinated by shadow hunters. They were part angel, as were the fair folk. Certainly there should be a kinship between them, but had never thought she would find one whose personality she could stand for more than 5 minutes, until Sebastian. They were also dreadfully self-righteous. Not Sebastian. He was most unusual for a human, and for a shadow hunter especially. "Not so often as you cut yourself on your wit, I think, my dearest," she said. "You know I do not wish to be called Your Majesty, but only lady or my lady, if you must. You do not seem to mind when I call you beautiful one, or my beautiful lady. His tone was not repentant.
Hmm,
she said, raking her slim fingers through the mass of his silvery hair. He had lovely coloring for a mortal, hair like a blade, eyes like onyx. She recalled his sister, so very different, not nearly so elegant. Was your sleep refreshing? Are you weary? He rolled over onto his back and grinned up at her. Not quite spent, I think. She leaned to kiss him, and he reached up to twine his fingers in her red hair. He looked at a curl of it, scarlet against the scarred skin of his knuckles, and touched the curl to his cheek. Before she could speak another word, a knock came at the door of her bedchamber. The queen called out,
"What is it?
If it's not a matter of importance, be off with you, or I shall have you fed to the Nixies in the river." The door opened, and one of the younger court ladies came in, Kaylee White Willow, a pixie. She curtsied and said, "My lady, Meliorn is here, and would speak with you." Sebastian quirked a pale eyebrow. A queen's work is never done. The queen sighed and rolled from the bed. "Bring him in," she said, "and bring me one of my dressing gowns as well, for the air is chill." Kaylee nodded and left the room. A moment later, Meliorn entered and bowed his head. If Sebastian thought it odd that the queen greeted her courtiers standing naked in the middle of her bedchamber, he did not evince it by any quirk of expression. A mortal woman would have been embarrassed, might have tried to cover herself. But the queen was the queen, eternal and proud, and she knew she was as glorious out of clothes as she was in them. "Meliorn," she said, "you have news from the Nephilim." He straightened. Meliorn wore, as he usually did, white armor in a design of overlapping scales. His eyes were green, and his hair was very long and black. "My lady," he said, and glanced behind her at Sebastian, who was sitting up on the bed, the coverlet tangled around his waist. "I have much news. Our new forces of Dark Ones have been situated at the fortress of Edom. They await further orders." "And the Nephilim?" the queen asked as Kaylee came back into the room carrying a dressing gown woven of the petals of lilies. She held it up, and the queen slipped into it, wrapping the silken whiteness about herself. "The children who escaped the Los Angeles Institute have given enough information that they know that Sebastian is behind the attacks," said Meliorn, rather sourly. "They would have guessed it anyway," said Sebastian. "They do have a regrettable habit of blaming me for everything." "The question is, were our people identified?" the queen demanded. "They were not," said Meliorn with satisfaction. "The children assumed all the attackers to be in Darkened." "That is impressive, considering the presence of fairy blood in that blackthorn boy," said Sebastian. "One might have thought they'd be attuned to it. What are you planning on doing with him anyway?" "He has fairy blood. He is ours," said Meliorn. "Gwen has claimed him to join the Wild Hunt. He will be dispatched there." He turned to the queen. "We have need of more soldiers," he said. "The institutes are emptying. The Nephilim are fleeing to Idris." "What of the New York Institute?" Sebastian demanded sharply. "What of my brother and sister?" "Clary Frey and Jace Lightwood have been sent to Idris," said Meliorn. "We cannot attempt to retrieve them quite yet without showing our hand." Sebastian touched the bracelet on his wrist. It was a habit of his, the queen had noted, something he did when he was angry and trying not to show it. The metal was written on in an old language of humans. "If I cannot reach heaven, I will raise hell." "I want them," he said. "And you shall have them," said the queen. "I have not forgotten that was part of our bargain. But you must be patient." Sebastian smiled, though it did not reach his eyes. We mortals can be over-hasty. You are no ordinary mortal, said the queen, and turned back to Meliorn. My knight, she said. What do you advise your queen? We need more soldiers, Meliorn said. We must take another institute. More weapons would be a boon as well. I thought you said all the shadow hunters were in Idris, Sebastian said. Not quite yet, said Meliorn. Some cities have taken longer than expected to evacuate all the Nephilim. The shadow hunters of London, Rio de Janeiro, Cairo, Istanbul, and Taipei remain. We must have at least one more institute. Sebastian smiled. It was the sort of smile that transformed his lovely face, not into something lovelier, but into a cruel mask, all teeth, like a manticore's grin. Then I shall have London, he said, if that does not go against your wishes, my queen. She could not help but smile. It had been so many centuries since a mortal lover had made her smile. She bent to kiss him, and felt his hand slide over the petals of her gown. Take London, my love, and turn it all to blood, she said. My gift to you.
You're all right, Jace asked, for what felt to Clary like the 100th time. She was standing on the front step of Armitage's house, partly illuminated by the lights from the windows. Jace was just below her, his hands jammed into his pockets as if he were afraid to let them free. He had stared at the burn marks he'd made on the wall of the shop for a long time before tugging his shirt down and practically yanking Clary out into the crowded street as if she shouldn't be alone with him. He'd been taciturn the rest of the way home, his mouth set in a tense line. I'm fine, she assured him. Look, you burn the wall, not me. She did an exaggerated twirl as if she was showing off a new outfit. See? There were shadows in his eyes. If I hurt you... You didn't, she said. I'm not that fragile. I thought I was getting better at controlling it, that working with Jordan was helping. Frustration curled through his voice. You are, it is. Look, you were able to concentrate the fire in your hands. That's progress. I was touching you, kissing you, and I'm not hurt. She put her hand against his cheek. We worked through this together, remember? No shutting me out, no epic sulks. I was figuring I could sulk for Idris in the next Olympics, Jace said, but his voice was already softening, the edge of hard self-loathing filed away, wryness and amusement taking its place. You and Alec could go for parasulking, said Clary with a smile. You'd get the gold. He turned his head and kissed the palm of her hand. His hair brushed the tops of her fingers. Everything around them seemed still and quiet. Clary could almost believe they were the only people in Alicante. I keep wondering, he said against her skin, what the guy who owns that store is going to think when he comes to work in the morning and sees two handprints burned into his wall. I hope I have insurance for this. Jace laughed, a small puff of air against her hand. Speaking of which, said Clary, the next council meeting is tomorrow, right? Jace nodded. War council, he said. Only select members of the Clave. He wiggled his fingers irritably. Clary felt his annoyance. Jace was an excellent strategist and one of the Clave's best fighters and would have greatly resented being left out of any meeting that was about battles. Especially, she thought, if there was going to be discussion about using the heavenly fire as a weapon. Then maybe you could help me out with something. I need an armaments shop. I want to buy a sword, a really good one. Jace looked surprised, then amused. What for? Oh, you know, killing. Clary made a hand gesture she hoped conveyed her murderous intentions towards all things evil. I mean, I've been a shadow hunter for a while now. I should have a proper weapon, right? A slow grin spread across his face. The best blade shop is Diana's on Flintlock Street, he said, eyes alight. I'll pick you up tomorrow afternoon. It's a date, Clary said. A weapons date. So much better than dinner and a movie, he said, and disappeared into the shadows. 5.
Measure of Revenge.
Maya looked up as the door to Jordan's apartment banged open and he raced inside, almost skidding on the slippery hardwood floor.
Anything? He asked.
She shook her head. His face fell. After they'd killed the Indarkens, she'd called the pack to come help them deal with the mess. Unlike demons, Indarkens didn't just evaporate when you killed them. Disposal was required. Normally, they would have summoned the Shadow Hunters and Silent Brothers, but the doors to the Institute and the Bone City were closed now. Instead, Bat and the rest of the pack had showed up with a body bag, while Jordan, still bleeding from the fight with the Indarkened, had gone to look for Simon. He hadn't come back for hours, and when he had, the look in his eyes had told Maya the whole story. He had found Simon's phone, smashed to pieces, abandoned at the bottom of the fire escape like a mocking note. Otherwise, there'd be no sign of him at all. Neither of them had slept after that, of course. Maya had gone back to Wolfpack headquarters with Bat, who had promised, if a little hesitantly, that he would tell the wolves to look for Simon and try, emphasis on try, to reach the Shadow Hunters in Alicante. There were lines open to the Shadow Hunter capital, lines that only the heads of packs and clans could use. Maya had returned to Jordan's apartment at dawn, despairing and exhausted. She was standing in the kitchen when he came in, a wet paper towel pressed to her forehead. She took it away as Jordan looked at her and felt the water run down her face like tears.
No, she said. No news.
Jordan slumped against the wall. He was wearing only a short-sleeved t-shirt and the ink designs of lines from the Upanishads were darkly visible around his biceps. His hair was sweaty, plastered to his forehead, and there was a red line on his neck where the strap of his weapons pack had cut into the skin. He looked miserable.
I can't believe this, he said, for what felt to Maya like the millionth time.
I lost him, I was responsible for him, and I goddamn lost him.
It's not your fault.
She knew it wouldn't make him feel any better, but she couldn't help saying it. Look, you can't fight off every vampire and baddie in the tri-state area, and the Praetor shouldn't have asked you to try. When Simon lost the mark, you asked for backup, didn't you? And they didn't send anyone, you did what you could.
Jordan looked down at his hands and said something under his breath.
Not good enough. Maya knew she should go over to him, put her arms around him, comfort him, tell him he wasn't to blame. But she couldn't. The weight of guilt was as heavy on her chest as an iron bar, words unsaid choking her throat. It had been that way for weeks now.
Jordan, I have to tell you something. Jordan, I have to... Jordan, I... Jordan.
The sound of a ringing phone cut through the silence between them. Almost frantically, Jordan dug into his pocket and yanked his mobile out. He flipped it open as he put it to his ear. Hello?
Maya watched him, leaning so far forward that the countertop cut into her ribcage.
She could hear only murmurs on the other end of the phone, though, and was nearly screaming with impatience by the time Jordan closed the phone and looked over at her, a spark of hopefulness in his eyes.
That was Teal Waxelbaum, second in command at the Praetor, he said. They want me at headquarters right away. I think they're going to help look for Simon. Will you come? If we head out now, we should be there by noon.
There was a plea in his voice under the current of anxiety about Simon. He wasn't stupid, Maya thought. He knew something was wrong. He knew. She took a deep breath. The words crowded her throat.
Jordan, we have to talk about something. But she forced them back down. Simon was the priority now.
Of course, she said. Of course, I'll come.
The first thing Simon saw was the wallpaper, which wasn't that bad. A bit dated. Definitely peeling. Serious mold problem. But overall, not the worst thing he'd ever opened his eyes to. He blinked once or twice, taking in the heavy stripes that cut through the floral pattern. It took him a second to realize that those stripes were, in fact, bars. He was in a cage. He quickly rolled onto his back and stood, not checking to see how high the cage was. His skull made contact with the bars on top, knocking his gaze downward as he cursed out loud. And then he saw himself. He was wearing a flowing, puffy white shirt. Even more troubling was the fact that he also appeared to be wearing a pair of very tight leather pants. Very tight, very leather. Simon looked down at himself and took it all in. The billows of the shirt, the deep chest-exposing V, the tightness of the leather. "Why is it," he said after a moment, "that whenever I think I've found the most terrible thing that could happen to me, I'm always wrong?" As if on cue, the door opened, and a tiny figure rushed into the room. A dark shape closed the door instantly behind her, with Secret Service-like speed. She tiptoed up to the cage and squeezed her face between two bars. "Simon," she breathed. "Maureen." Simon would normally have at least tried to ask her to let him out, to find a key, to assist him. But something in Maureen's appearance told him that would not be helpful. Specifically, the crown of bones she was wearing. Finger bones. Maybe foot bones. And the bone crown was bejeweled, or possibly bedazzled. And then there was the ragged rose and gray ball gown, widened at the hips in a style that reminded him of those costume dramas set in the 18th century. It was not the kind of outfit that inspired confidence. "Hey, Maureen," he said cautiously. Maureen smiled and pressed her face harder into the opening. "Do you like your outfit?" she asked. "I have a few for you. I got you a frock coat and a kilt and all kinds of stuff. But I wanted you to wear this one first. I did your makeup, too. That was me." Simon didn't need a mirror to know he was wearing eyeliner. The knowledge was instant and complete. "Maureen, I'm making you a necklace," she said, cutting him off. "I want you to wear more jewelry. I want you to wear more bracelets. I want things around your wrists." "Maureen, where am I?" "You're with me." "Okay. Where are we?" "The hotel, the hotel, the hotel." "The Hotel du Mort." At least that made some kind of sense. "Okay," he said. "And why am I in a cage?" Maureen started humming a song to herself and ran her hand along the bars of the cage, lost in her own world. "Together, together, together. Now we're together. You and me, Simon and Maureen, finally." "Maureen, this will be your room," she said. "And once you're ready, you can come out. I've got things for you. I've got a bed and other things, some chairs, things you'll like, and the band can play." She twirled, almost losing her balance under the strange weight of the dress. Simon felt he should probably choose his next words very carefully. He knew he had a calming voice. He could be sensitive, reassuring. "Maureen, you know, I like you." On this, Maureen stopped spinning and gripped the bars again. "You just need time," she said with a terrifying kindness in her voice. "Just time. You'll learn. You'll fall in love. We're together now. And we'll rule. You and me. We will rule my kingdom, now that I'm queen."
"Queen."
"Queen. Queen Maureen. Queen Maureen of the night. Queen Maureen of the darkness. Queen Maureen. Queen Maureen, Queen Maureen of the dead." She took a candle that burned in a sconce on the wall and suddenly poked it between the bars and in Simon's general direction. She tipped it ever so slightly and smiled as the white wax dropped in tear-like forms to the rotted remains of the scarlet carpet on the floor. She bit her lower lip in concentration, turning her wrist gently, pooling the drips together.
"You're a queen?" Simon said faintly. He'd known Maureen was the leader of the New York vampire clan. She'd killed Camille, after all, and taken her place. But clan leaders weren't called kings or queens. They dressed normally, like Raphael did, not in costumey get-ups. They were important figures in the community of the Knight's Children. But Maureen, of course, was different. Maureen was a child, an undead child. Simon remembered her rainbow arm warmers, her little breathy voice, her big eyes. She'd been a little girl with all the innocence of a little girl when Simon had bitten her, when Camille and Lilith had taken her and changed her, injecting an evil into her veins that had taken all that innocence and corrupted it into madness. It was his fault, Simon knew. If Maureen hadn't known him, hadn't followed him around, none of this would have happened to her. Maureen nodded and smiled, concentrating on her wax pile, which was now looking like a tiny volcano.
"I need to do things," she said abruptly, and dropped the candle still burning.
It snuffed itself out as it hit the ground, and she bustled toward the door. The same dark figure opened it the instant she approached. And then Simon was alone again, with the smoking remains of the candle and his new leather pants, and the horrible weight of his guilt.
Maya had been silent the whole way to the Praetor, as the sun had risen higher in the sky and the surroundings had turned from the crowded buildings of Manhattan to the traffic-clogged Long Island Expressway to the pastoral small towns and farms of the Norfolk. They were close to the Praetor now, and could see the ice-blue waters of the Sound on their left rippling in the cool wind. Maya imagined plunging into them and shuddered at the thought of the cold. "Are you all right?" Jordan had hardly spoken most of the way either. It was chilly inside his truck, and he wore leather driving gloves, but they didn't conceal his white-knuckle grip on the wheel. Maya could feel the anxiety rolling off him in waves. "I'm fine," she said. It wasn't true. She was worried about Simon, and she was still fighting the words she couldn't say that choked her throat. Now wasn't the right time to say them, not with Simon missing, and yet every moment she didn't say them felt like a lie. They swung onto the long white drive that stretched into the distance toward the Sound. Jordan cleared his throat. "You know I love you, right?" "I know," Maya said quietly, and fought the urge to say thank you. You weren't supposed to say thank you when someone said they loved you. You were supposed to say what Jordan was clearly expecting. She looked out the window and started, jerked